What would you do to help the world if you could spend £30,000 a week for the next 1,000 years? Well, that's how much the government are spending on Trident missiles. Don't facts like that just wipe you out?
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 27th of January 2023. Streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in synchronicity in parallel in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything but Google, please. That is to say the Google Play Store, just avoid it like the plague, if you don't mind. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner that's been gaslighting us with its military psychological warfare propaganda, smearing those cheap COVID treatments. Remember that? Test lorry told us the TV lied and an estimated 60,000 Brits died. Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity now supposedly vanished. In a great Ukraine psyop, turning a blind eye to failings of cocaine-snorting Zio-Nazi hero Zelensky and masochistic Russian sanctions. An unhappy bunch of death trip deep state losers on a hiding to nothing, waging war on the British people now as well as Putin. So, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forums, Fourth Industrial Revolution is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, I think we better start really by looking at, we're looking in the first part at the missing Albanian kids, at the Zahawi story. Also, David Lammy, who is the Shadow Foreign Secretary, talking about Labour's foreign policy. Nice to see Labour actually coming out with some policies there. PR tactics seems to be saying absolutely nothing about what they intend to do. Have a bash at the Tories, and actually that may win them the next general election as the Tories make so many mistakes. And also murdered for her bed. Dr. Verla Coleman talks about a story of a woman injected with morphine and midazolam just to get her out of the way, even though she might possibly have recovered. I'm also be looking at the story here in Bristol, where those who have retreated from the housing market and bought themselves boats living in the harbour are now being stitched up with a 300%. In fact, the council would deny that, but some of them say it's a 300% increase in their mooring fees, apparently to make sure that the Bristol Harbour is all spanking new and there's enough money coming in to make it look gorgeous, almost like they're being treated like cattle in pens, being told to pay for their own prison. Rather than just looking after the harbour, the council isn't doing its job. It's going to make loads of them homeless, and it's trying to impoverish people who are already poor, even though, of course, the city's got lots and lots of much amazing amounts of wealth, particularly amongst the slave trading merchant venturers who don't seem to ever get a mention by our marvellous Marvin the Mayor. In part two, another episode in a series, I think it's eight of little episodes we'll be doing over the next few weeks, of Mark Purdy from this tape which YouTube purged, recording an interview I did back in the year 2000 with the farmer, organic farmer Mark Purdy. YouTube, when they got rid of my 15 million views channel called Public Inquiry, they also got rid of this little video. I think very important one, so we have another extract from that today. Also looking, obviously, at the tanks. All these tanks going over to Ukraine to help the Ukrainians. We get Scott Ritter's take on that. And Stoltenberg's take on it too, the UN, the NATO Secretary General. We also have a chat with Ian Davis, who does some stuff for UK Column, but he's also a human being in his own right, on the accelerationists, accelerationism, and the idea of trying to cause as many conflicts as you can all at the same time to bounce humanity into some new world order. And also, Martin has a story for us on Cambridge Analytica. And we wind up with a look at, does the UN have a religion? These are the sorts of questions that you don't get on radio for. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartels, then by Ofcom a few weeks afterwards. Cancelled us, that is, off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not quite cancelled here yet. So, Martin, I think we'd better start by looking at the Zahawi story. I mean, it's just amazing to see that he's still in his job. Even many Conservatives calling for him to go now.
Yeah, well, I think what it indicates is that if Sunak's position was stronger, he would either be able to say, back off, I'm going to, you know, he's my man, or he'd be able to say, I'm going to get rid of him. But since Sunak is basically there because he's the least worst option that the Tories could come up with after the disaster of the Truss Kwarteng mini-budget, he can't do anything about it.
People are pointing at Hunt as well and saying, actually, he's the one that the Conservative Party earlier this year rejected as PM. And yet, all these people who were the membership said we don't want them are now all in all the key positions.
Well, don't forget, when the Conservative Party used to be the governing party of this country back in the 50s and 60s and so forth, there was the Conservative Party members never got a say. That's an innovation. The Conservatives represent old money and power, and those who identify with that vote Conservative or join the Conservative Party, but they never had any direct say.
Well, okay, so things have moved on a bit, but the members and many of the backbench MPs as well saying, look, you've got to get rid of this guy because the brand is being tainted. It's almost as if, I mean, I hate to say this, but Rishi Sunak is there to taint the brand. Of course, he's been loyalty maybe more to the City of London than it is to the Tory membership.
Well, I think the reason why the Tory MPs decided to go for him after the Liz Truss Kwarteng fiasco was because they didn't want the members to have another say, because the members would have probably done stuff like, you know, Boris Johnson could have come back. And of course,
some saying he still might.
Well, yes, of course, he's still manoeuvring away. And the Tory party has become an ungovernable series of fiefdoms and gangs who can't get on with each other. And, and of course, they're not actually managing to govern the country either. But there we are. We are where we are.
I mean, doesn't this happen every once in a while when a party's been in power for a couple of terms that it's just simply time to swap over to the other party like they do in the state? In fact, I would suggest maybe British politics is becoming more and more like US politics all the time with the puppet on the left and the puppet on the right.
Well, indeed. And there's a lot of similarities between the way they do things and the way we do things. I think it depends, Tony. You know, in previous weeks here, I've talked about Kerala in India as being a very successful place and really, you know, over many years, very high level of human development, even though it's quite a poor place. And that's because the Communist Party and its allies have been elected and re-elected ever since the 1940s. You don't necessarily want to change every time. It depends what they're doing, doesn't it?
Well, Camilla Cavendish used to be the director of the number 10 policy unit between 2015 and 2016 for a very short time under David Cameron. She's also known as Baroness Cavendish of Little Venice. But she is currently a journalist, not quite sure where she is now. She's done a book called Extra Time in May 2019. And also she was friendly with Joe Johnson, who is Joe Johnson?
Boris's brother.
Boris's brother.
Who's now also a
peer.
Who
is also Joseph Edmund Johnson, Baron Johnson of Marylebone. Yeah, these people love giving each other gongs, don't they?
Well, indeed. I mean, it's a very incestuous thing, and you know, it's a cronies cult, isn't it, really?
But anyway, Camilla Cavendish is an interesting woman. So let's have a listen to her now talking on, I think it's on the, World at One, a couple of days ago, about this whole business of whether or not to sack Nadeem Zahawi. Let's just also refresh everyone's memory. Nadeem Zahawi, former chairman of Le Cercle, which is a fascist international group, which has been going in Europe ever since. I would suggest probably funded by a far-right aristocracy in Europe ever since before the Second World War. But anyway, this is what Camilla had to say about this whole business of Zahawi staying, even though he's quite obviously a tax dodger who's in charge of all of our tax and obviously not trustworthy as a minister, and yet he's clinging on like a little Star Trek Klingon.
I think the pitch is completely overshadowed by the fact that most of us hoped that Rishi Sunak would bring back integrity to the government. And the fact that he has not sacked Nadeem Zahawi is utterly bewildering. It's bewildering politically because he doesn't actually owe Zahawi anything. And it's bewildering because I think whatever the details of this unbelievably complicated offshore trust and the quote-unquote error that Mr. Zahawi made which resulted in him having to pay a penalty to the HMRC while he was Chancellor collecting taxes from the rest of us, it is quite obvious to me that he's not fit to be in office. And I mean, obviously, we're being told that this issue was not raised at the Chequers Away Day.
Seems I think he was in the room. And awkward. But there's a process, Camilla.
Awkward, you know.
In the big picture, whether you sack him this week or next week,
I don't agree with you.
Does that make a difference?
Yeah, I think it matters enormously. I mean, look, you know this, Evan. I mean, the gravity of politics means he's going to go. This is what always happens. He will go in the end, and every day that goes past, Rishi Sunak doesn't just look weak, I think, but there's something much bigger here. I think we've got to a point in society where there's a certain section of very wealthy people who think it's clever to avoid tax. Tax avoidance is legal, and I think that very concept is becoming somewhat absurd, and I think Sunak needs to stamp that out, and we need a new level of transparency in our politics and our tax system. And if I was a Rishi Sunak, I would have actually announced a radical programme of tax simplification so that people can't make these kind of casual errors.
In a sense, you're saying whatever they do, and the word sleaze is going to hang over them and is going to distract and is going to cost them probably the next election. Is that your point?
Yes, and look, some of this is obviously the legacy of Boris Johnson, who was cavalier and casual, and pretty much everybody he touched has been tainted by him, and our politics has been tainted by him. But that makes it all the more important that whoever came in after him had to clean that up. Number 10 believe, by the way, that voters haven't really noticed the Zahawi scandal, you know, that it's all about due process. I think the truth is that we Brits believe in fair play. And the truth is, when you see that kind of dogged tax solicitor who went up against Zahawi and started asking difficult questions, it's a David and Goliath story, right? And most of us, we're filling in our tax returns this week, and we are David.
Camilla Cavendish, Baroness Cavendish, thank you.
So there she was, director of the Number 10 Policy Unit with David Cameron. So she is an ex-insider, Martin. She's saying the whole thing's a farce, really, saying the gravity of politics. I like that expression. She's saying gravity of politics means he's going to go anyway. So, why don't you just lance the boil, get it over with?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? If you say she was in Cameron's team, she probably represents what's left of the One Nation Tory tradition.
Well, she's now one of the directors of Policy Exchange, which is a right-wing think tank.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, but nevertheless, some of the things she was saying there are not in tune with modern Conservative Party mainstream thinking.
Well, what about this idea of that it's clever to avoid tax? Of course, Rishi Sunak himself, his own family and his wife, was avoiding paying tax as well. I mean, it seems to me as if they're trying to get a bunch of people to run the Tory party who are all into this.
Well, I think in actual fact it's very widespread. You know, there are two kinds of people in the Tory party, the incredibly wealthy who are in politics to, you know, make sure that their wealth is protected, and the not so wealthy who intend, when they leave politics, to make a load of money like Boris Johnson. So, I mean, you know, the Conservative Party has been the party of the chequebook from its inception. I mean, that's what it's about. It's protecting the property of the propertied classes. That's their main goal.
Well, she's also pointing out that Number 10, and it's great to have someone, I thought, they didn't didn't even mention it on, that was the PM programme there a couple of days ago, that she had been policy director at Number 10. I mean, she really was an insider there at that point, that actually she's married to Hugh Van Steenis, who is senior advisor, the chief executive of UBS, the big Swiss bank. I mean, these are serious, big time investment banker types, who she's married to anyway. And they're saying, look, this is just crazy. What on earth do they think they're doing? So I wonder who it is that's advising a Number 10, saying, oh, don't worry about it, everything's going to be fine, that maybe they're a secret agent working for the Labour Party.
Well, I think what you've got is that the old money, if you like, they find all of the grabbing and blatant greed of the new money rather offensive. And they feel that if we carry on like this, then everybody's going to question whether there should be billionaires at all. Mm. So in other words, Zahawi's letting the side down by, you know, getting caught, basically. If you're going to do this stuff, make sure you don't get caught, and then we won't hear anything about it.
But he has been caught, and he's still there. This is the trouble. Mm. And also, of course, it may be that what you've got here is you've just got a bunch of people who are tax avoidance people, and it's almost like a kind of little cult of them. So they are all trying to look after each other. Because they know that actually they've got skeletons in their own closet. It may even be, mightn't it, that Nadeem Zahawi, especially with all these intelligence connections through the Pinay fascist circle, the fascist international group, that he may have some dirt on Rishi Sunak.
Well, it may well be the case that they've all got dirt on each other. I mean, underlying all of this is the idea... I'm stretching my mind to think what I wanted to say there. Well, the whole idea of tax cuts, it's ideology in the Tory party. The purpose of the party is to deliver tax cuts.
Well, Sunak isn't doing that, is he?
No,
he's
isn't
saying,
doing that.
He's saying, we need to hang on until economy picks up, which it won't, and then we can do it later.
Yeah, but I mean, in any case, what people have got to recognise is after the 2008 crash, there is going to be no tax cuts for wealthy people for at least 40 years. You can't even talk about it because we, the rest of us, the PAYE people, bailed the banking system out, which protected the wealth of the wealthy classes. Now, if they are going to be bailed out as they were in 2008, they cannot be asking for any kind of tax cuts or public expenditure cuts, cutting the stuff we use, until that's sorted out.
Well, it seems there's
and
a
it's
bit
not
of
been
a...
sorted out,
no.
So they can't have any tax cuts.
But it's in a kind of groupthink around all this, isn't there? But even within the Labour Party, that, oh, we can't really touch those with lots and lots of wealth because we rely on them for our political support and our economy, you know, if the money's taken off them, our economy might start to tank. But of course, they're the only people with actually enough money to run the country, so they need to be taxed.
Yes, and I think obviously the main fundamental flaw in the Kuateng budget was that he wanted to cut taxes on the wealthy, and the hedge fund managers who would have actually benefited from that could see that it wasn't viable, and they shorted the pound and crashed the government.
Yeah.
Because even though they themselves would have benefited from it, they could see it wasn't viable, because it isn't viable.
Yeah. I wonder if they have any kind of feedback loops in their discussions they have with these city financiers that seem to be running the show. But anyway, the hero of the day, really, is a guy called Dan Needle, from The Independent, and he was helped a bit by a woman called Anna Isaac from The Guardian at the time. And there was a terrific thing, and I'll put the full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk on this week's Radio 4 media show, explaining how the story came out, or it nearly, of course, didn't come out. And one of the major problems that these journalists face is threatening letters from lawyers. And, of course, Zahawi just presses a button with all of his millions that he's got, or billions, however many it is. And every time someone does start, it looks as if they've got intelligence that one of these journalists is onto them, then they send a letter to the boss threatening, you know, that hell will fall down all around them if they dare to publish the story. So there was a lot of work, a lot of time and effort went into getting this story out and to digging this dirt on Zahawi by the London journalists. This particularly, as I said, Dan Needle at The Independent.
I would pay huge tribute to the media lawyers I had both at The Guardian and The Independent, who have to sort of weigh things sometimes a bit differently, but have cancelled it and have sort of allowed each stage of this reporting process to go ahead. You know, the stories have been published. But I do think what Dan's illustrating, and there's a broader point here, not talking about this story in particular, there's a broader point here about how the legal system in general might be used against public interest journalism. There are a lot of cases at the moment. For instance, there's one involving the permission given by the Treasury for the legal actions of someone linked to the Wagner Group against a journalist, Elliot Higgins. So what we're talking about is a broader context for journalism in the UK, and I think it's really important that we consider this as part of a bigger picture, and that Dan's contribution is part of this bigger picture that's very important.
Because these letters are off-putting. They are.
They have to be treated very seriously.
People off.
Yeah, and is that line between using them as a signal, am I being fair? Am I being proportionate? Am I doing my job properly? And that line between trying to suppress journalism, that's what our media lawyers have to try and weigh for us and help us consider.
And obviously I should make clear that Mr. Zahawi's lawyers have said that they, you know, sent just a polite, confidential letter through the solicitors to Mr. Needle to correct a few inaccuracies. You know, this is fairly common practice legally, Dan Needle, but you chose to make the responses public. Why was that?
It is indeed common practice for libel lawyers to send letters which ask people to retract and then claim that they're confidential letters and can't be published. It's common practice, and it's a disgrace. And the Solicitors Regulation Authority, I asked them, has now confirmed that solicitors may not do that.
It was interesting, isn't it? I just wonder whether you see yourself now as a journalist, and if you do, you know, where you think you stand in terms of being impartial. You know, lots of people could read your blog and think, you know, you get the sense that you set Nadine Zahawi in your sights, and you know you were going to get him. That was what you were up to.
I really wasn't. And if he'd responded saying, for example, yes, I think there are. I think you're making some mistakes in what you say, but I think you're identifying some issues that I need to look at more closely with my advice. I'm going to do that. I won't get back to you all the details because it's confidential, but I'll let you know roughly where we get. And thank you, Dan. If you'd done something like that, then not only would I have walked away, but I would have looked like an absolute idiot if I had pursued him aggressively. So it was his denials that made me certain in my mind, and the way that he was behaving that made me certain that he had something to hide. And of course he did, because it turned out at the same time he was sending me those letters, he was engaged in discussions with HMRC to settle the tax liability that he was denying to me that he had.
So Dan Needle there from The Independent, fantastic bit of journalism, mate, well done. But, Martin, this story nearly never saw the light of day because of all these legal threats that the journalists and the Independent newspaper and The Guardian were getting.
Yeah, it's one cheer for journalism, but you know that this is the tip of the iceberg, and that other people have got away with all sorts, and we don't know anything about
it. One of the things Dan was saying on that, and as I said, I'll put a full link to that interview with Dan and the lady from the Independent from the Guardian up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which goes right into one of the things he says there is that the Independent have said, look, because of all this heat on you, Dan, I know you've got two or three other bombshell stories, they're just going to have to go on hold until this is all over. So of course, you know, this has had a bit of a chilling effect anyway on the investigative journalism. He explained that his work originally, before he got into journalism, was as a tax lawyer. So he would go into the tax affairs of companies, and in fact he was commissioned by people who were about to do hostile takeover bids, whatever, of companies, to go into their tax affairs, and this was part of the deal. We'll buy you, but Dan has to come in and have a good old look at your affairs to see if there are any skeletons in your tax closet. So a company may have not paid some tax it's supposed to have paid. Dan would winkle that out, and then of course that money would be paid to HMRC before the people bought the company up. So he started off as just someone who goes into the tax affairs of businesses for perfectly normal legitimate reasons, to make sure that companies haven't been dodging tax before they go to the, you know, to be sold off, and then he gets in and he suddenly realizes actually there's a journalistic angle to a lot of this. I would imagine actually what he was doing was chatting with journalists in London and saying, look at this amazing thing here. And they said, well, actually, you'd make a good journalist, Dan. And of course, he is.
Well, there's a lot of overlap, is there not, between investigative journalism, police investigations, and intelligence agencies. You know, they're all the same skill set, aren't they? Which is why, you know, psychological warfare is an extension of public relations and vice versa. I mean, we are small fry in that great big pond, Tony, and there's others in the pond of all sorts. I mean, she mentioned Elliot Higgins there, who supposedly was made redundant before the Syrian war broke out and then became overnight an expert in everything that was going on in Syria and has now become essentially a paid shill for the British intelligence services. And, you know, he started off as a nobody just blogging, but there you go.
Well, we'll be getting on to the Elliot Higgins story in a minute, actually, or the Bellingcat story in a minute. But first, final look at the Zahawi scandal. I mean, the reason I think this is so incredible is, first of all, that some of the main people calling Rishi Sunak out for not sacking Zahawi are Tories. In fact, they had the head of the of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs yesterday, Martin, saying, well, we don't impose fines for mistakes. And so it clearly wasn't a mistake. He was definitely dodging tax.
He was deliberately trying to avoid what he owed.
And it's good to see, you know, that the HMRC actually taking on the government and, of course, taking on an ex-Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, who's now in charge of everything, and another ex-Chancellor of the Exchequer, taking these people on. It's great.
Well, if you think about it, if you're a senior civil servant and you basically have to put up with an awful lot from these people, and once in a while you get a chance to give them a kick back.
So yes, Minister isn't quite true. It's more the other way around. The ministers are manipulating the civil servants, you think?
Well, I think it's a struggle. And of course, the civil servants may be corrupt or in the pocket of other interests and so on. But it depends. I mean,
who's in charge? The ministers or the civil servants?
It's hard to say, and it depends.
Sometimes on, one, maybe some, sometimes
yes,
the other.
Exactly. It's a struggle, and of course, you know, the civil service has been comprehensively undermined in the last 30 or 40 years, and they've brought in loads of people from the private sector who haven't worked their way up through the ranks or whatever. It's like appointing people to be a police inspector who hasn't done any policing, but they're good at managing companies. You know.
And back to Camilla Cavendish's point, you know, Boris Johnson was a bit silly when it came to his parties and Partygate and things, but this seems to be a whole new level, a whole nother level, higher increment of corruption here going on, and he's doing nothing about it. So isn't it interesting? You know, I find this fascinating, the way that Sunak led the charge to get rid of Johnson, but actually it already looks as if he's more corrupt than Boris was.
Well, the thing is, virtually everybody at the top of the Tory party have got their snouts in the trough. So it's you know, you can imagine if everybody's doing it, you think you're going to get away with it. I can imagine Zahawi thinking, as he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is climbed to the top of the greasy pole, this is a perfect opportunity for me to get away with not paying my taxes.
Absolutely right. And he's looking around, as Camilla says, at everyone else, all of the small fry of the world, collecting taxes from them and making sure he's not paying his own. But anyway, Starmer, here he is at Prime Minister's Questions, tackling Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, over the Zahawi affair.
Does the Prime Minister agree that any politician who seeks to avoid the taxes they owe in this country is not fit to be in charge of taxpayer money?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to make my position on this matter completely clear to the House. The issues in question occurred before I was Prime Minister. With regard to the appointment of the Minister without portfolio, the usual appointments process was followed. No issues were raised with me when he was appointed to his current role. And since I commented on this matter last week, more information has come forward. And that is why I have asked the independent adviser to look into the matter. Now, I obviously can't prejudge the outcome of that, but it is right that we fully investigate this matter and establish all the facts.
Mr. Speaker, he avoided the question. I think anybody watching would think it's fairly obvious that someone who seeks to avoid tax can't also be in charge of tax. Yeah. Yet, for some reason, the Prime Minister can't bring himself to say that or even acknowledge the question. Nope. Now, last week, the Prime Minister told this House that the chair of the Tory party had addressed his tax affairs in full, yeah, and there was nothing to add. This week, after days of public pressure, the Prime Minister now says there are serious questions to answer. What changed?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I know he reads from these prepared sheets, but he should listen to what I actually say. Since I commented on this matter last week, more information, including a statement by the Minister without portfolio, has entered the public domain, which is why it's right that we do establish the facts. And Mr. Speaker, let me take a step back. Now, of course, the politically expedient thing to do would be for me to have said that this matter must have been resolved by Wednesday at noon. But I believe in proper due process. That's why I appointed an independent adviser, and that's why the independent adviser is doing his job.
But the opposition can't have it both ways. The shadow leader, his party chair, both urged me and the government to appoint an independent advisor. And now he objects to that independent advisor doing their job. It's simple political opportunism, and everyone can see through it.
Well, he says it's simple political opportunism, and it's basically simple politics. It's suicidal for Sunak not to have sacked Zahawi, as we heard from the Conservative peer earlier. And you don't need to wait for an inquiry into something where it's been shown that he's paid a fine to HMRC for trying to avoid tax. It's already established fact, isn't it?
Is it a fine of £5 million, 30% of which is a extra fine? Apparently, it was around about £4 million that he avoided paying, or evaded, I think you can fairly say. He's paid a fine. He evaded £4 million in tax whilst Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yes, and in any case, this so-called independent ethics advisor, I mean, two of previous...
We had a chat about that a few weeks ago, didn't we?
Have resigned because... He's a banker, this guy.
But
in any case, the Prime Minister can overrule his ethics advisor. They've got no power. It's not like a court, a police investigation or anything. And, you know, I mean, it was recommended that Priti Patel should go for bullying, and that so should Dominic Raab.
But it's just been overruled. Who is it that Nadeem Zahawi hangs out with? Well, he hangs out with an international coalition of right-wing intelligence veterans, propaganda assets, and top politicians who shaped the 1970s and the 1980s. My God, that's a big thing to say. But this is WikiSpook's entry on Le Cercle, formed in the 1950s, they say, although, Martin, you suggest, and I've also seen some evidence that it was around before World War II.
The Pinet Circle was formed before the Second World War.
But it changed its name to Le Cercle.
They
wanted to get rid of the guy's name because he was a bit of a Nazi.
Yes.
A bit like Windscale or something. You know, just change the name and hopefully everyone will forget who they are. So it was intended to cement Franco-German relations as a buffer to Soviet aggression during the Cold War. But, of course, after the Cold War, it carried on a bit like NATO, like a kind of running sore. Down the years, however, it's become much more advocating right-wing causes around the whole world and growing into a confidential talking shop for about 70 politicians, businessmen, polemicists and personnel from the diplomatic and security services. So it seems to me they're always on their lookout, Martin, for the most ruthless right-wing, and the sort of people that would have been involved from MI6 in the assassination of Princess Diana, for example, to invite them in there, people who are prepared to be absolutely ruthless. And of course, MI6, as just one of those intelligence services, has got its kind of cosy image with James Bond being this swashbuckling hero that Ian Fleming wrote about. But MI6 isn't really like that at all, is it? The intelligence people, when they retire, they actually retire with quite a lot of blood on their hands and skeletons in their closet. That if the public knew what we were paying for in their international dealings, they would be horrified, shocked, and probably disgusted and want them out.
Yeah, Hambro's Bank was where MI6 people ended up often when they retired. So there's a revolving door between being involved in the intelligence services and being involved in banking and all the rest of it. So this is how elites are orchestrated. Intelligence services are the coordinating function for these elite groups. Yeah. I mean, you know, these elite groups
intelligence services are like the operative, the operational wing of things like the Le Cercle.
Yes, that's right. And of course, they're also linked with people with money and military connections and so on. I mean, and the way in which these things actually work is opaque and deliberately made to be opaque, apart from a kind of mystique around it all, which is totally unjustified. People think that the British, for example, MI6, they're obviously not as dirty. I mean, we know the CIO overthrew Pinochet. We know that they were involved in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, where, you know, thousands of people were tortured to death. But the British, of course, the image they like to project is that they're not like that, and they're gentlemen. But in actual fact, MI6 is, and MI5's history, because MI5 used to be in charge of the colonial side of the British Empire. It wasn't MI6 who set up the concentration camps in Kenya in the 1950s. It was MI5. And the point is that the British intelligence services are extremely nasty. And, you know, there's plenty of people in Ireland
no wonder they managed to lobby for a law exonerating them in case they commit murder or any other criminal offence.
Why would you want to do that?
Amazing.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
And also associations between Le Cercle and Operation Gladio. And its fanatical anti-communism was basically do absolutely anything in order to smear the Soviet Union. And of course, Operation Gladio did that rather effectively, didn't it?
Well, it wasn't about smearing the Soviet Union. It's trying to prevent progressive politics from coming to any kind of...
Yeah, but they were blaming the Soviets. They were saying, oh, the Russians are doing this stuff. They're infiltrating into civil society in the West and in Europe, particularly in Italy and places like that. And they're actually funding terrorism over here.
No, but what they were doing, terrorism in Italy, was being carried out by the intelligence services through various cutouts. In order to prevent, democratic process in Italy from coming up with anything that
trying to make is that they were trying to blame the Soviets for this terrorist attacks, which were actually carried out by them, fascists, Zahawi's little group.
Yes, and of course, it may well be that if you asked Zahawi about Gladio, he wouldn't know anything about it.
Maybe.
Rishi Sunak didn't know anything
about the inquiry into Zahawi's tax affairs when he was Chancellor.
I suspect that many of these people who are in these little groups do not know what goes on. They are dupes they're dupes in their own way. Some people do know, and they are knaves. Hmm. Others are simply fools.
Well, I would suggest that somebody like Sunak would have known about Zahawi and his tax affairs when he was Chancellor.
But if you ask the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, about Gladio, he would look at you blankly. It's not in his CV to have researched anything like that or ever thought about it. And you see it the same with Labour MPs. They say, Kerry McCarthy in East Bristol. Well, I spoke to the intelligence services and they told me there was nothing in it. And you think, well, you're an MP, do you believe them? And of course they do. They do believe them, which is more fool them.
So Ted Shackley was another person. Do you know much about him, Martin? He was a big US character involved in Le Cercle, and apparently he initiated this thing in the 1950s and 60s, where Le Cercle would have its two meetings a year, one in North America and one in Europe.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's another one of these networks, like the Bilderberg Group, there's various others. The Mont Pelerin Society was very influential in terms of forcing through neoliberalism. And there's overlapping membership in these groups. And you can imagine, as Adam Smith said in The Wealth of Nations, business people only very rarely get together, even on a social occasion, without some conspiracy against the public being cooked up.
I was sort of bowling you a ball there about Ted Shackley, because he was CIA station chief in Miami during the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was one of the key people.
Surprise me at all, but the name Shackley, I mean, obviously, I do not have in my mind all of the various CIA agents who have ever existed.
Well, he wasn't an agent. He was a station chief at the CIA in what they call, just looking this up now, JM Wave Miami Station. It was central to both the Bay of Pigs and Operation 42 attempts to overthrow the government of Cuba by training Cubans to overthrow their involvement
in the assassination of JFK.
Almost certainly. So these are the sorts of people, I suppose it's like a bit like, you're right, like the Bilderbergers. These are the people responsible for the destruction of the Western democracy since World War II. And Zahawi's there, up there as a chair of this meeting.
I imagine that Zahawi would have joined this group as a way of making him, of ingratiating himself in the right sort of circles. That's the way I read him.
He gets quite dirtied up in an organisation like this when Martin and I realise what he's actually up to and who he is. So it's, in a way, I mean, it's just a fantastic job done by these London journalists getting the story out. But anyway, back to the Bellingcat story. I'm curious about the name of Bellingcat. He's this... Elliot Higgins is a journalist who has been funded in the past. I'm not sure if he's still funded by something called the Atlantic Council. So not a million miles away from Le Cercle, who are seen to be very close to this kind of Atlanticist group of, British and American ex-diplomats and right-wing types. Bellingcat, the name, what does that really mean? It's only his nickname, Elliot Higgins' nickname, but it sort of says something, doesn't it? A Bellingcat.
Well, to bell the cat... is a traditional saying, isn't it? Who can bell the cat? Put a bell on the cat's neck, and then the cat, you can always find the cat.
So it makes it more difficult for it to kill the birds or the mice or whatever, because they can all hear it coming and they can fly away.
In other words, belling cat Elliot Higgins, because it was originally him blogging away supposedly from his own private house. He'd been made redundant, I think, from something, I can't remember what he'd done before, selling something or other. And then he appeared out of nowhere in 2011 and suddenly became an expert on all the weaponry that was being used in Syria and saying where it all came from and so on and so forth. So what he is, in fact, is he's an astroturf investigative journalist created by MI6. So it wasn't clear to begin with that he was MI6. He's just some random person. But over time, he'll be linked to things like the Integrity Initiative, which again is government funded.
But never mind.
Bellingcat is funded by NATO.
Actually, I'm just looking him up, Martin.
And the intelligence services.
I'm just looking him up on Wikispooks, which was where we were on looking about the brilliant Wikispooks, by the way. Don't bother with Wikipedia, folks. Set yourself up an account on here and give Wikispooks your information, because it won't then be destroyed by bots, at least hopefully. I mean, in fact, Robin, who runs Wikispooks, I was chatting to him not so long ago, and he was saying, oh, well, we just denial of service attack, we got taken out, we had to move the servers to another country, because the site has been under attack quite a lot. Just like, I think, isn't it called the Intel Drop? We were chatting to one of our American guests recently about that. They were under attack. These websites that are telling the truth are constantly under attack and having to move around the world in order to survive. So, fantastic that the publishers of the sites actually take the effort, but this is one of them. Anyway, so Integrity Initiative is actually formerly a funder of Bellingcat. And so, yes, Tranche 7 of the Integrity Initiative leak revealed that Bellingcat had, with the Integrity Initiative, worked closely with the Integrity Initiative and made a bid to create the Expose Network, which is another thing. Multi-million-pound alliance to counter Russian disinformation. So, you know, this is one of the things that Elliot Higgins does, is he makes these funding applications to not only fund himself, but also to create new organisations that are anti-Russian propagandists.
Yeah, and the whole thing is presented as if these people are genuinely fearless, independent investigators, and they're actually on the payroll of the intelligence services, which is extraordinary if you think about it. And therefore, they then put out what is essentially NATO disinformation, but the pretense is that it's, if MI6 was to come out and give an MI6 press conference saying things, people think, hang on a minute, they're paid to lie. Whereas when Bellingcat says it, Elliot Higgins, just a little guy, it sounds as if it's got some more plausibility. But of course it hasn't. It's basically a lie factory. That's what it is.
Well, okay, so let's just have a little look, though, at what Bellingcat has been up to. In fact, there's a very good, on Wikispooks, a really good list of the various organisations that have been funding it. The National Endowment for Democracy, which is US intelligence. Something called the Open Society Foundation, which is George Soros. And I'll just put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to this page of Wikispooks about them. But I think we need to just remember what they've been involved in. All of the main facts to do with the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury were first revealed by Bellingcat, Martin.
Yes, so in other words, they are a conduit for the disinfo of the Western intelligence services. And, the pretense that they're somehow independent is absurd. I mean, you and I are genuinely independent. You know, I just get paid a little bit by Russia Today. You get a little bit of money from Press TV, but it's not nothing. These people make a career out of what they're doing, and they get well paid for it as well. But, of course, they're well paid. And it's actually our taxes, a lot of it, that's paying for this. And then, of course, extra money is bunged in by various billionaires and so forth. But they are in the business of systematic mind control and disinformation.
Well, folks, you can read this for yourself on the Wikispooks site, but there's one or two I'll pull out most definitely. One is the James Foley fake video. On the 23rd of August 2014, Bellingcat made an estimate of the exact location where the James Foley execution video was made, outside Raqqa, a reported Islamic State stronghold in north-central Syria, and yet failed to notice that the video itself was a fake, a proven fake, to which there are many references, that actually there was a video analysis revealed the truth, that it was actually faked. The whole thing was faked.
Yeah. So the way...
In fact, I got a video taken off the internet because I was questioning whether this was true, and it was said to be insulting. So YouTube took it down. But actually, yeah, the video was a fake. The James Foley fake video.
These people are conscious disinformation agents. They're not just like journalists like Richard Norton Taylor on The Guardian.
Well, he wasn't the only one. Just be fair to him for a minute. I mean, he wasn't the only one that didn't notice the video was fake. Apparently, the whole Western press thought the James Foley video of him being beheaded by ISIS was real.
Yes. But and of course, if you actually, you know, the genuine analysis, there are serious intelligence officers in the Syrian intelligence services, the Mukhabarat or whatever, who will be going through all of this and saying that's a fake. That's, you know, the intelligence services need to know what's really happening. But of course, they've also in the business, like James Le Mesurier was in the business with, you know, the sponsor of the White Helmets. They're in the business of creating. It's called Strategic Communications, STRATCOM. Our old chum Sven Hughes is involved in this game. Ex-British Army psychological warfare officer, now running his own show. The kind of mechanisms of propaganda that used to be used were quite complex back in the day. You know, if you read the book about Op JB or you know, the Manning book about Bormann. In the 40s, there was a lot of skullduggery going on and double-crossing and so on and so forth. But modern psychological warfare operations are even more... they're more convoluted because the media environment in which they operate is more convoluted. Social media has created an immense opportunity for the distribution of false information, and it's not... people like us that are distributing the false information. It's the government.
Point out that there were quite a few fake Osama bin Laden videos, weren't there? We've almost forgotten this.
Yes.
But, you know, it was somebody dressed up as him. It clearly wasn't actually the guy, you know, because he died around about the time of the 9/11 attack.
And of course, if you remember in the Abbottabad incident where bin Laden was supposedly killed by Navy SEALs, they had to admit that there was no live feed, so they had Obama and Biden watching a live feed from Abbottabad. Oh, they've got Osama. But in actual fact, there was no live feed, and of course there was no live feed because what happened there was completely different from the story we were given. As any Pakistani taxi driver will tell you in Bristol.
How come the Western press, the editors, the producers, even the individual journalists themselves go along with so much of this?
Well, because that's where the side their bread's buttered on, isn't it? If you start questioning too much of this, you can't have a career in journalism.
Well, okay.
Seymour Hersh had a career in journalism back in the 70s in the US, and, you know, he was able to carve out a niche for himself as a genuine investigative journalist, and there was a genuine hunger for genuine investigative journalism.
John
Pilger has managed just about to survive as a mainstream journalist, but if you have got kids in private school and a mortgage and all the rest of it, you can't go down that road. It's more than a job's worth.
Elliot Higgins is presented as a sort of edgy John Pilger of today.
Oh, that's right. So, in other words, this is what the situation is called, recuperation. So everybody likes the idea of edgy investigative journalism. So what we do is we just give you edgy investigative journalism, except it isn't edgy investigative journalism. Yeah. It's just us.
Marketing.
Telling you the same.
It's marketing.
Yes.
Oh dear. Anyway, this all popped up at Prime Minister's Questions this week. This whole business of Elliot Higgins apparently being sued by a Russian oligarch for saying that he was some sort of major figure in the Wagner Group, I believe.
Live effort.
Yes.
In 2021, the government enabled Yevgeny Prigozhin, former chef to Putin and founder of Wagner, to dodge UK sanctions to pursue a case in London against British journalist Elliot Higgins, who had exposed Prigozhin's link to Wagner. Prigozhin believed that silencing Higgins would get his sanctions lifted. The overriding of UK sanctions was approved by the Treasury when the Prime Minister was Chancellor. Prigozhin's English lawyers wrote that serving notice on Higgins, and I quote, will require Treasury approval. So what values did the Prime Minister apply when he allowed a Putin warlord to use our courts to try to silence a British journalist and undermine UK sanctions?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm proud of our record in leading, actually, when it comes to sanctioning those people connected with the Putin regime. I think at last count we've sanctioned over 1,000 people and frozen tens of billions of pounds of assets. I am aware of the case he's raised. We are looking at it. But there is, as he knows, OFSI, who deal with the licensing situations in these matters. But I'm happy to get back to him on the specific case that he raised.
So that's all brought up, and he's raised a specific case as if he knows nothing about it. I'm sure Sunak does know what's going on here. The Wagner head has sued a journalist. So this is a group of Russian mercenaries, and what Elliot Higgins has said about him, he says, well, I could come into the High Court in London and I'm going to sue you for libel because what you said is not true.
Well, I think it's from some while ago, isn't it, this?
It's very much current now, though.
Well, yes, it is. Of course it is. But I mean, I'm just saying, it's from a while ago.
The trouble is, of course, what if Prigozhin wins this case in the High Court against Bellingcat?
What you've got is oligarchs are allowed to use the British courts to sue people who criticise them. And, of course, it's the British courts which decided, for example, to impound Venezuela's gold reserves. The British courts are where most commercial stuff is settled, which is why oligarchs come to Britain to settle it. What's happened since then, of course, is that some oligarchs have fallen out of favour, and therefore there's now a question about why they're allowed to use our courts. But, of course, I suspect, I don't know who the MP was who made that question, but I suspect that this is a planted question by our own intelligence services. To make Prigozhin look bad, Elliot Higgins look good, and in actual fact, the public as a whole is having the wool pulled over its eyes at every stage of the game. Because, of course, they know nothing really about the detail of this stuff. They just get the general gist of it, and it creates an atmosphere around the situation.
Trying to get to the nitty-gritty of the story, which the questioner in Parliament there, or not, neither Sunak answering did, is that just before the legal case was originally brought, Higgins's website Bellingcat published a story naming Prigozhin as the man behind the Wagner Group. Now he says, no, I'm not the man behind the Wagner Group, I'm prepared to come to the High Court in London to prove it.
Well, I don't know whether that's true. Prigozhin these days, I mean, I've read stuff that he's been saying recently, and he's pretty clear that he is the guy behind it. So I don't know why he would have been in those days saying that he wasn't.
He may have lost the case. Well, in any case, surely this is for the High Court to decide.
Exactly, for the courts to decide, if they're genuinely independent.
And what's
the courts
happened
should
is,
decide it,
and
they?
What's happened is, as a result of this, maybe the Americans now, and they're egging the British on to do it, have banned. They've said that Wagner is a transnational criminal organisation, basically a bunch of terrorists, and of course that they should be way beyond the law. That a terrorist group can't come along and sue you. You know, so they're trying to make sure that the cases like this can never happen again.
Yes, and of course they made the Iranian Revolutionary Guard have been named as a terrorist organisation. It's like the Provisional IRA used to say, British government, political wing of the British Army. You know, it's Prigozhin's, the Wagner Group are, they're like Kinimini Services or any of the other Sandline. All of these groups which are linked to the British Special Forces, but of course they go off to do jobs that the Special Forces wouldn't be allowed to do, like, for example, the assassination of a environmental regulator in Colombia, and there was a TV programme on this years ago, because I used to be involved in Colombia Solidarity, where these guys were in the SAS, based in Hereford. They were said, would you like a three-week holiday in Colombia and do a little job for us? So they went over there, assassinated this guy because he was trying to find BP, and then they come back and put on their uniforms and they're back in the SAS.
So
Wagner is used in a very similar way by the Russians.
Is anything going to change if Labour get in?
No. They're in the pocket.
Okay.
Apart from people like Jeremy Corbyn and so on, who's no longer a member of the Labour Party.
Oh, dear.
And, of course, he went to talk to the intelligence services when it was a danger of him becoming Prime Minister. And, basically, they then used that, the stuff that was in the conversation he had with them, to bring him down.
It seems the deep state hate people like Jeremy Corbyn almost as much as they hate the Russians.
Well, the Integrity Initiative, one of the things that came out was that they were actually using tweets to undermine Corbyn. So they're a government organisation paid by the British government. You know, our taxes, because we're the taxpayers, not Nadim Zahawi, we're paying the taxes, and then they use those taxes to undermine our elected representatives to make sure that they control the outcome. And they've got plenty of resources, and you know, I mean, you mentioned earlier that the law that was passed to make the intelligence service, the police and the army above the law. We've passed that law. This Tory government has passed that law. If they tried to pass such a law in the Russian Duma, they'd be laughed out of the room. Because you've got a full spectrum of forces in the Russian Duma, from the far right to the far left, and none of them would accept the intelligence services to be above the law.
So
because of the
happened?
History of the country.
How has this culture been allowed to arise, that where these questions are simply not asked? They should be. That surely is what a parliament is for.
Well, in Russia, the Russian parliament is a relatively recent innovation. And don't forget that Yeltsin shelled the first iteration of it, killing hundreds of people. And we cheered him on because that parliament was trying to block the important thing, Tony, which is privatisation.
Yeah.
You've got to have privatisation. Yeah. It doesn't really matter about how much around democracy you've got. It's the privatisation.
Finance capitalism. Well, we've got two finance capitalism parties, folks.
Well, that's right. And that's why we're stuck in this. Is because it's very difficult to break out of it when you've got this deep state, which is linked to the military industrial complex, the pharmaceutical industry, the banks. They control things, and there's they shuffle things around.
Michael Hudson,
to make sure that you're never going to get
Michael
a chance
Hudson
to,
and me
to,
are going to start a mixed economy party, and we are going to win anyway. In this last week, we've had the Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy talking about his idea of what Labour will do in foreign policy. This is, of course, at the Royal Institute for International Affairs. I'll just let you say something about them, because it's an interesting venue to do this. This is Chatham House, isn't it?
Yeah, and Chatham House is, it is the vehicle for all of these neoliberal ideological stuff. And, of course, David Lammy, who might be the Foreign Secretary, I suppose, he's basically going to the Royal Institute for International Affairs, and he's showing that he's one of them and can be trusted and all the rest of it.
He's doing a bit what Starmer did last week at the WEF in Davos,
isn't
he?
That's right, yeah.
Saying, look, it's okay, guys, you can back us, give us your money, we will win, and we will do what you want once we win. So he's not really interested in what the voters got to say. And of course,
well, he is interested in what the voters got to say, but only you know, he's watching the safe Labour seat.
He's watching the Tory party implode. He doesn't need to worry too much about what the voters have got to say.
No, this is the problem, is that we have such, you have a completely incompetent, useless Tory party, and then, of course, the Labour Party takes over, but they've been purged, and they're not going to do anything.
No.
And then when they get removed, then we'll go back to having a useless and incompetent Tory party in charge.
And
meanwhile, the finance capitalists and the deep state continue on their reckless road to nowhere.
One or two little Corbynite thoughts that are allowed to flourish within the Parliamentary Labour Party will immediately be chopped off as soon as they surface by the Starmer government when they take over, as I confidently say they will, at the end of next year. So anyway, let's have a listen now to David Lammy at Chatham House. Chatham House, really the equivalent of the American Council on Foreign Relations. It's a private think tank, which a lot of businesses that want to influence foreign policy shovel money towards. And they're based in St. James in London, a very nice little headquarters there, Royal Institute for International Affairs, originally started as part of the roundtable groups in the will of Cecil Rhodes as the Council on Foreign Relations was. So here's David Lammy. He's giving us an idea of where he's going when he takes over as Foreign Secretary if Labour win the next general election.
Europeans are more than just trading partners. We share security and fate in this changing world, in Kyiv, in Kosovo, and with terrorism right here at home. We need a Britain reconnected for security. That's why we will pursue a new UK-EU security pact to complement our unshakable commitment to NATO. We will seek to institutionalise new cooperation across foreign policy through regular EU-UK summits and structured dialogue, both at the political and official level. As my excellent colleague and friend, the Shadow Defence Secretary, John Healey, has said, we would negotiate new mechanisms for cooperation on hybrid threats between EU and UK defence industries. The specific areas of cooperation are, of course, a matter of negotiation. But from sanctions to energy security and space capabilities and new technology, we can see how developing deeper connections with Europeans can make Britain stronger and safer. We need to think about security in a holistic way. Tanks, planes and ships matter as much as they ever have, but they are just the tip of the security iceberg. Today, conflicts are also waged by controlling energy prices, by using critical technologies or resources as bargaining chips, by cyber attacks and misinformation, by detaining foreign nationals. Threats are often in the grey zone. The Russian state murdering people on UK soil with a chemical weapon, influencing operations against our democracy, targeting parliamentarians. These threats need a coordinated response. And that is why today I'm announcing that Labour will create a new joint FCDO Home Office State Threats Cell, working in partnership with the intelligence and security agencies to assess state threats, disrupt hostile actors, improve resilience in both government and the private sector, and coordinate with international partners. Labour, we will build the foundations of our defence, lead in NATO, build new ties with Europe, and strengthen Britain's resilience. Next, I want to talk about prosperity. Because growing up poor in Tottenham in Thatcher's Britain, I know the pain of living through a cost of living crisis. Every week, I meet constituents still suffering from a lack of opportunity and the indignity of choosing between eating and heating. Keir Starmer's Green Prosperity Plan will reindustrialise the UK, supporting the creation of over 200,000 jobs over the next decade. But we're not alone in wanting to accelerate into green industries. China, the United States, the European Union, all taking steps to become green superpowers. China already has the largest market share in every single stage of solar panel manufacturing. And the US has passed the landmark Inflation Reduction Act. I welcome efforts to accelerate along the path to net zero from other countries. But if we do not use our power smartly, we risk falling behind. That is why our £28 billion Green Prosperity Plan will use our many strengths, such as our position as a world leader in wind power and our renewable research base, to build political, scientific and commercial alliances to grow prosperity in the UK.
The second part of that was his pitch to the wider country. You know, Starmer's going to reindustrialise Britain, we need to be in the green technologies, blah, 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 cost of living crisis. The first bit was him sucking up to the military intelligence establishment and showing that he's absolutely on side with everything that they believe and that he's totally safe pair of hands from their point of view.
Well, we're going to be hearing from Scott Ritter
The Skripal affair and all the rest of it about how the Russians do this and the Russians do that, the evil Russians, blah, blah, blah. And of course, it's pretty common across the political spectrum in this country. I mean, you feel like saying, but if there's a letter in the Times from the week after the Skripal affair saying that nobody was being treated in Salisbury Hospital, this is from the doctors, for nerve agents. But there's a whole huge farrago of nonsense that's been created around it, even though we've got
the evidence. It can't all be nonsense, can it?
Well, it can all be nonsense, because this is what your taxes go to fund. The whole Skripal affair is a great big theatre run by MI6. Nothing happened there. Apart from Skripal possibly got murdered by the British, like Berezovsky.
I'm in the NUJ Journalist Union's branch in Wiltshire, and we had a meeting, I think it was just about 6 weeks after the whole Skripal thing, and one of the most interesting things I picked up from some of the Wiltshire journalists was that the guy who was chief constable, I can't remember his name right now, but it was his first day in office, when all this happened.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he'd been brought in from another, he didn't know anybody in Wiltshire, he didn't know anything about, and it all just happened on his first day at work. So obviously he wasn't really in charge. And of course, one of the other things that people may not realise is that Wiltshire Constabulary are involved in investigating something like this for about 10 minutes. It's then the Metropolitan Police's counter-terrorism branch that take over everything. All those local detectives, all those local officers are taken out of the way, and they then come under London's command, which is Neil Basu, who commands the same unit as which is the counter-terrorism command, and is the same people as Wayne Cousins and Bastard Dave and these coppers who've been
up to no good. Well, they're diplomatic protection, but they're all connected.
No, but they're all in the same unit, controlled by Neil Basu, who's who also controls the counter-terrorism.
Well, the special demonstration squad of the Metropolitan Police was directed by MI5. So, you know, this is what we're dealing with. It's an octopus with its tentacles all over the place.
It is, and we'll be hearing a little bit more about the police later. Another clip from John Wedger, the interview I did with him last week, I thought was fascinating, and I missed it. I mean, it was about an hour long interview, 50-minute interview. So many interesting things John was talking about. He's an ex-detective who was a whistleblower and elbowed out of the... In fact, he nearly lost his home and everything from the Metropolitan Police because he just refused to lie about child sexual abuse that was going on in London. So we'll be hearing a bit more from him in a minute. But we're going on to look much closer into Bristol now, zoom in on Bristol, because we've had a rather horrific decision, and it seems a very quick one as well, rather than this taking a long time. Of course, when the council changes big things in the city, almost anything it does, which affects the people of the city, they have to launch consultations. Well, this one has been... It seems either incredibly short or entirely ignored by, almost entirely ignored by the City Council, and particularly by the Mayor, Marvin Rees, who's still in charge until this time next year. One of the things he seems to be doing before he goes, because we as Bristolians voted to get rid of the position of Mayor, to bring back the old system with our 70 councillors forming all these committees to run things and having to talk to everybody else about what they're doing rather than just do it. Chatted to by people like the Merchant Venturers and other powerful people in the city. This is one of the things I've found over the years. This, as power gets centralised, the rich and powerful love that because they've only got one person to go and talk to get them to do what they want, rather than lots and lots of them to compromise. So here's the mayor at Cabinet here in Bristol. On Tuesday this week, I think it was around about 4, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, something like that, in the evening, at Cabinet, talking about this decision to do with the boats.
So on to agenda item 21, which is what I think lots of people are here for, Bristol City Docks Fees and Charges Review. I'm going to introduce this report. So it's been 20 years since the last Fees and Charges Review, and a lot has changed in that time. So a review of our fees is overdue. The city and the harbour both have changed together over those 20 years. The population of the city has continued to grow, 395,000 people in 2000 to 472,000 today. And the use of the harbour has changed, where there used to be a lot more businesses around there, business-based and warehousing, but now it's much more about individual boats. But what hasn't changed is that this hasn't been as open and inclusive a part of the city as we would want it to be for the whole city. And while the harbour is synonymous with the city's identity, it's not equally accessible to all Bristolians. So we all want a fantastic harbour for all people from across the city and beyond to be able to visit, to live, and to work in. And we do have a good harbour, but it's not at the level that we want or need it to be. But if we want the harbour to be all it should be, it means we have to invest in the harbour and what's around it. So fees have actually fallen in real terms, and the harbour makes a loss. We need the harbour to become self-sustaining, which means raising the investment to fix the crumbling infrastructure and modernise the facilities. The importance of the harbour paying its way is even more so given the financial pressures on the council, which means, among other things, that we're looking to reduce the cost of adults and children's social care services. There's a pressure on parks, libraries that we've been holding off, and all the other pressures we've worked through today in our budget from domestic violence to new children's homes and our emergency support schemes as well. So it's essential for the city and for the harbour that it becomes self-sufficient. The fees recommended are in line with benchmarking exercises we've run and bring us back in line with comparable harbours and facilities to make this a commercial rate. These fees aren't introduced until April, and in the meantime, we will undergo a series of engagement opportunities with user groups to notify them of the proposed changes. And this will allow us to provide clarification and also give users an opportunity to raise any specific issues. So on this report, we've received one public forum petition and 79 public forum statements and 50 questions. So the petition is from George Colwee. So George, you have 1 minute to present the petition. I'm guessing you're there. There we go. I'll give you a 10-second warning as well.
With just 5 days' notice before the submission deadline, we have amassed a petition with over 2,200 signatures demanding Marvin Rees withdraw support for the new harbour fees until a consultation and impact assessment have been undertaken by engaging with all impacted stakeholders. The Mayor yesterday published on his website a piece attempting to pin the decades-long failure of the Harbour Authority squarely on the shoulders of boat dwellers, painting them as abusers of a system. He's also misrepresented a clause in leisure use licences to BBC Radio Bristol and on his blog. This all demonstrates how ill-informed his office is. He's been swept up in a yarn as a result of his own neglect to uphold the democratic process and is now demonising a community of good working people.
Just 10 seconds, okay?
He clearly doesn't know about the 4 years of groundwork the Boaters Association has done to try and secure the very thing he has accused boat dwellers of deliberately avoiding, securing liveaboard licences. We even conducted a needs assessment of harbour users last year. We
that's
have the data. Let us show it to you.
Okay. Thanks very much.
So that's Bristol City Council Chamber, a little bit more subdued than the House of Commons this week. But I'm joined in the studio by Mandy Sharman, who's the Bristol Boaters Community Association's chair. Hi, Mandy.
Hello.
First of all, how many people are in boats in the harbour?
Roughly over 100.
Right.
Yeah, over 100. And that's just people that came forward to do our survey.
And amazing what we were just hearing there. In 5 days, 2,200. Now, hang on. If there's only a small number of people in boats, to get 2,200 on your petition is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
In 5 days, why only 5 days to respond? So it sounds like you may have been bounced into something. They're trying to bounce you into something here.
It was all a very big surprise. I mean, this harbour operation review has been spoken about for years. I'm not sure how long it's been undertaken for. But we got together as a community of people because we heard that this review was happening and it was about to finish in 2019. Fair enough, we had COVID in the middle, but we sort of got together as an association so we could have a seat on the table. And there's we've had just so many tries at getting just getting some sort of engagement or communication going on with the Harbour Office, multiple emails from the Mayor's Office. We are here and we want to be consulted and we want to be part of these changes.
Well, okay, so the Harbour Office, it sounds to me as if they're saying that the harbour is going to have to start turning a profit. And now, is that reasonable?
Yeah, perfectly reasonable. Everyone wants to see a successful harbour and there to be improvements in facilities.
But surely the council, the idea of us paying our council tax, the council is supposed to then manage the harbour, and it doesn't, you know, it just seems to me that so much of this business thinking about everything's got to turn the profit, it shouldn't necessarily be doing that to the harbour. We pay our council tax that the harbour is invested in and that we have these sorts of facilities. So anyway, he's also saying there that you know, there's not enough money for children's homes, all this sort of thing, and so you guys just need to cough up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it completely feels like that. And that 20 years of no increase in fee, other than the sort of basic interest rate level, why has that happened? You know, why has there not been incremental increases over the years? All of a sudden, we've got a surprise announcement that in April a 20-year increase is going to come onto the boaters' heads all in one hit with 2 months' notice.
So you have been having increases, but they've been in line with inflation.
Yeah.
Well, in which case, why does it have to be another increase now? I mean, surely it sounds to me as if actually he's misrepresenting the situation there. He's trying to make out that, oh, we've had 20 years with nothing, no increases in rent. Well, the rent has been increased. It's not rent, sorry, it's mooring fees, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it just, it's such short notice. There's been absolutely zero consultation. There's a lot of people in here with just a lot of passion and a lot of drive, and they love Bristol, they love the harbour, they love the water, they want to bring everyone down here. But it's like all being held back, that the harbour being a successful entity in its own right and being financially sustainable. So many people with so many ideas on how they want to progress the place, but they're not talking to anybody. And the only thing we've seen is the fee increase. That's it. There's no further information.
I mean, there must be some kind of body where people like you can sit and talk to the council. I mean, I can't believe that the city council can be in a situation where they've got hundreds of people living in the harbour that they're not talking to constantly. I mean, there's surely issues coming up all the time. Issues to do with safety, pollution, all sorts of stuff's going to be happening. Maybe kids playing in places that they're not supposed to be playing, and, you know, people who are living in their boats can keep an eye on it in conjunction with the council. Surely there must be somebody that you and the council have been talking to each other over the last 20 years.
Yeah, well, since personally I was just a little person on a little boat. I've been doing that for 12 years, and when we got wind of this engagement opportunity and this big consultation process that was going to happen, we thought we'd get together. Once we've all got together to form BBCA, we've got this like official dialogue going on with the Harbour Authority, and we've spoke to lots of different other sort of representative groups as well. So it's really opened the door for us, like mobilising as a community. But it's still just a really difficult process to navigate, and the sort of user group meetings that they held haven't been put back on since COVID. There was one a couple of weeks ago where we were...
So is this groups... Sorry, just to get it clear, is this with the council or with the harbour?
With the Harbour Authority, right. That was. Yeah, Bristol Harbour Recreation Users Group. I got an invite to that early in January, and we were ensured the consultation process will be beginning in April. And then, surprise, surprise, in the meantime, a member of ours accidentally stumbled across this cabinet meeting where this new fee... increase and proposal of the new licensing model was going to be approved. Surprise. And we have 5 days to prepare for that.
This is really bad practice, isn't it? So what they're trying to do is sneak it through, really, without letting people know. So obviously we've got a big round of applause there for one of the boaters speaking at the City Council chamber. You know, how's this been going down amongst people living in boats here?
Everyone is just completely shocked at just the way the fee itself and the cost increase itself isn't the most shocking factor, to be quite honest. It's going to be a big hard hit for lots and lots of people. But it's the way they've gone about this. This review has been dragging on for so many years with this promise of this really thorough consultation. And there's another forum that I attend called the Harbour Forum, and it's sort of more for the businesses, and the Tourist Information Board and the Harbour Authority and Bristol City Council feed into that. And everyone in there is just waiting for some information from the council. And it's in the pipeline. It's coming, apparently, in February, so I look forward to that. But it's almost a little bit too late and I think the mayor said engagement to notify the users of the changes. And to me and many other people, engagement isn't just notifying somebody of a change.
I'm very sorry, but the council do have to do proper consultations for any changes by law. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a chap called Ben Ewing. He was one of the people who was granted permission to speak by Marvin the Marvellous Mayor at the Cabinet meeting on Tuesday, and this is what he had to say.
So I'm here today for my family, my young family, and I'm asking for your help and your protection. We are boat owners, members of Cabot Cruising Club, members of Bristol Boating Community Association, and owners of a small local family business. My wife and I are self-employed electricians, and we have worked in, on and around Bristol Harbour for years, including events, infrastructure for ferry boat companies and for boat owners. I have a roof over my head, and I provide for my family. I've been living on my boat for 14 years. I found out today from a website that the mayor has put up that
I am abusing the system and damaging the city's ability to manage the harbour for all, not for the privileged few. Yesterday, I was planning for my family's future. Today, I am vulnerable.
Okay, thank you.
So that's Ben Ewing there speaking on Tuesday. He's saying, I'm asking for help because he's now feeling vulnerable. So here's a family that could be bankrupted, evicted, etc. So surely he's not the only one in that situation.
No. And well done, Ben. I mean, that was talking from the heart there, wasn't it? I mean, there's many families on boats in the harbour. It's a real diverse community, and it's a very precarious sort of place to be in.
Well, it is. It was until 5 days before Tuesday. Well, this time last week, you know, it seems to me that, you know, you suddenly this has descended on you like a bombshell. Suddenly, you've got to find a load of money from nowhere. Obviously, you know, most people don't have that money. They may have to sell their boats to raise that money if it starts to accrue as a debt. This is an attack on living in the harbour.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And I mean, a boat is cheaper than a house. Completely. The mooring fees are reasonable. I cannot deny that.
Can you just give us an idea of how much someone like you would be paying for a year to live in a boat in the city? Because I know for my own friends from years gone by, for many of them that thought, look, actually getting a mortgage is far too expensive. I'm going to just get to live on a boat. In fact, I'm also friendly with some of the people that do magazines for example, the Kent and Avon Canal boating community. There's a lot of people living like this that are doing that because they don't have the money to get a mortgage.
Yes, exactly. It's a really, I think it's a really valuable stock of affordable housing to be right in the city. Yep, that's a fantastic place to be. It's for some people it's a choice and it's what they want to do, and it's sort of quite dreamy and picturesque to live on a boat. But for other people it isn't a choice and it's an only option, and if they haven't got that option, then what are they going to do? Where are they going to go? And that's going to see a mass exodus of people on boats in the harbour, not just people living on the water, but also the businesses as well.
It's funny, isn't it, because we've had lots of luxury housing. In fact, Tony Blair bought one of these luxury flats, whatever it was, 20 years ago, for his kids. Loads and loads of luxury housing building up. Maybe it's that the people who are living in this luxury housing don't like looking down on a ragtag of boat people living down there.
Yeah, there is that opinion out there, but I think if you want to live in a property by the water, you kind of have to look at the water and the boats in it, don't you?
I mean, I think what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that it seems it's fine for people to live in very expensive property on the harbour, but not if it's cheaper. So an affordable housing, you mentioning affordable housing there, a lot of it is just simply not affordable. I mean, it's called affordable housing. But we've now got the situation where the government's taken away things like the Help to Buy scheme for first-time buyers if they want to buy one of these affordable houses. And they are, the companies are just failing. They're building the places. And at the moment, the housing market seems to have tanked. The value of these places is going down, and they're finding it difficult to sell them. So what do you think is going to happen? I mean, where are we at now with this? Because this has landed on your doorstep, on your poop deck, if you want, as a sort of bombshell. Whereabouts is the community going to go with this?
There's just so much upset around there. I mean, there'll be a fraction of people that just simply cannot afford it, and then they'll be selling their boats and sort of dropping off from underneath.
There must be people right now thinking, right, I'm just going to have to sell. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to get out of town or go somewhere else.
But all we've got to think about at the moment, because the only thing we know is about this fee. That's the only information we've got. A big flaw about this whole thing is that there's complete lack of evidence, and Marvin quoted about the benchmarking study. Where is that? We want to see that. What have we been benchmarked against? Because I can guarantee they might be going for a like-for-like with the costs, but the facilities that they offer and the services that we use, they are going to be anywhere near the standard.
I'm sure if Marvin was sitting in here, which he would never do because he doesn't even reply to emails inviting him to come and talk to us, he'd say, well, actually, what you're going to get for this is Rolls-Royce facilities in the city, in the harbour.
Well, why don't they say that? If that's the intention, if we're going to pay X amount in for X amount more years, what's the priority list of what improvements we're going to see? There's no dialogue whatsoever. I think people will be able to take it on board a lot more with the increased fee if yes, there needs to be a lot more warning and maybe some sort of staggered approach. But if there was some sort of indication of what they're going to do, or are they going to take our money and mismanage the harbour for another 20 years?
It sounds like, Martin, I'll bring you in on this. I mean, the housing market is in a bit of a mess anyway, isn't it? We know that for many, many people, particularly first-time buyers, it's just impossible to afford a mortgage and impossible to afford to buy a house. Is the idea that everyone just has to rent now? And rent with the rent fees are astronomical, aren't they? Private rented sector is in a terrible mess.
Well, I mean, as you know, there was a Radio 4 documentary, was it last week or the week before, about the housing crisis in Bristol, which we had quite
last week.
It was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I think it was Evan Davis and the PM programme actually came to Bristol to look at the problem with. Well, it was mainly to do with building massive office blocks everywhere. It seems to me that actually the thrust of that programme was, what is the council actually doing? Because the property speculators, seem to be totally in charge of the policy.
Well, and of course they had that meeting where they discussed the possibility of rent controls, which of course the council doesn't have the power to enforce. And the gentleman who spoke at the beginning of the debate in the council chamber was saying, well, I've got a young family here. Mm-hmm. Now, if they have to sell their boat, they're going to go onto the council waiting list, aren't mm-hmm. they?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that solve the problem?
Well, they're going to join the 18,000.
Yeah, they join the 18,000 on that list. And you'd have thought that if they were going to do something like this, they would try and assess, well, who in these boats is actually vulnerable and needs, you know, because if we just evict them, they're just going to end up being coming down the other side of the council house saying, well, you're going to have to house us because I've got three kids here or whatever it is. And obviously the thing that really screams at you is that they haven't bothered to discuss this with anybody. They've just decided to do it.
I mean, it's almost like the boaters are having to deal with a faceless corporation rather than a human being that we've elected to be
also,
the mayor.
I imagine if the idea is to make this a commercial exercise, then people with wealthy people with very posh boats will be welcome, and poor people with rather shabby little boats will not.
Well, look, you're a member of the Labour Party. We've got a Labour mayor. Why is this going on in Bristol?
Well, I don't know, because this is the first I've heard of it, just like yourselves. You know, I mean, why would I know? It strikes me that this is probably the officers who are driving this, because they have their own little agenda of what they want to see in lots of things.
What about the property speculators? Well, they look at the boaters and they think, well, they're getting something for nothing down there.
Yes, exactly. So, in other words, what are we talking about when the decisions about housing, really, the council is trying to do its best, but the reality is the property bubbles in this country are built into the way we run things, so that if you get on the housing ladder, you can make a fortune. And of course, if you're a big property owner, you make a really big fortune. Other people can't get anywhere decent to live at any price. And if you think about it, people like his electrician, I mean, you need people like that. But if they can't find anybody,
you need teachers.
Bristol City Council. Where can they live?
Not at Bristol City Council. People like that don't get jobs at Bristol City Council. They'll be employing, conglomerates from somewhere else, a chain of electricians from around the world who are contacts with their, international mates. There are bigger companies, a big chain. That's the way that the council seems to work. Just a minute, because he's... the mayor has been calling these boat dwellers privileged and abusing the system.
Well, I mean, that just sounds like having a tin ear, doesn't it? He's not actually spoken to them. He's not made any assessment of who they actually are. And, of course, the other side of this is to say, well, these people aren't paying in enough. And, you ought to find out who they are, surely, before you start making statements like that. It's a safety valve, just like people living in vans is a safety valve.
You've just echoed the cartoon on the Christmas edition of the Bristolian. Marv the robot, the tin-eared tin boy, easy to wind up, apparently.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to you, Mandy, because we've talked quite enough about this. What do you think's going on and how to fix it, do you think?
Well, they've admitted that it's been sort of mismanaged over the decades. And this issue, the cost of living crisis, the housing crisis, is all piling on top of the fact of why living on a boat is more desirable. It's more achievable for so many more people. It's the same with the van dwellers and all the different fractions of people that are classed as no fixed abode. It's just an increasing thing. And it's the system that doesn't allow these people to to survive or flourish in the way that the council can deal with. I just don't think they know what to do. But as a first case, just come and speak to people. And that's where we come back to the evidence, complete lack of evidence. The Qualities Impact Statement says that there is no impact on its service users. How on earth is that ever true?
It's difficult to know where to start. I mean, this is, I think, in a way, why they do spring these things on people is because you think to yourself, good God, where do we start with this? It's such an enormous, you know, it's basically a threat of eviction. Mm. I mean, I would have thought that some of the boats, at least, have got engines and they could chug along to out of Bristol and moor up somewhere else. Is that what people are thinking about doing?
Yeah, certainly is. But moorings are hard to come by. There's waiting lists. The river is chock-a-block with boats. It's a really a problem which is just multiplying day by day. We knew this review was coming. We were waiting for the engagement process. One of the things that we really thought would happen, because it's a council statutory duty, is an accommodation needs assessment.
It sounds to me like you might have to take them to court and say, well, look, you know, you can't do this without this assessment.
People are mentioning things like that in the community, but to me it seems... I just don't see why it should even get to that point. We're sort of here making a plea to please speak to the community, understand what these proposals actually mean for real people, well, families and businesses.
I mean, surely this is kind of, Martin, this is kind of ruled by accountants, isn't it? The accountants at City Hall have said, well, we need to get rake more money in. The government's giving us less. We've got loads of special educational needs kids that we took the money away from, and we've now been told by the High Court we've got to give them more money. We need to find out, some sort of cost centre somewhere. The boaters are just another cost centre they need to rake some money in from.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because I imagine even if they put the fees up, the boring fees, it's not going to be a big money spinner, is it?
No.
We're talking peanuts here. You know, I mean, how are they going to invest in the harbour by increasing the mooring fees? I mean, you might get a bit of extra money. But if you drive out the small boaters, are you going to get an influx of wealthier boaters who are going to pay more? But even if you did, it's still small beer. To build a piece of infrastructure around the harbour costs millions, you know. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to cover that, is it?
Well, there's been quite a bit of press around good old Alex Seabrook, who's one of the local democracy reporters here in Bristol. Bless him. Has done an article for the Bristol Post, warnings over Bristol Harbour fee hikes, which could make boat dwellers homeless. An upcoming huge hike in fees to use Bristol Harbour could make boat dwellers homeless, a community group has warned. Ferry operators also said many small businesses on the docks face going bust if the proposed fee increases are introduced in April. But apparently the mayor doesn't care about local businesses going bust because they're not big businesses, who are his chums, even though he's supposed to be a Labour mayor. And also today, Alex has penned an article. Actually, no, sorry, this is Wednesday. The mayor says sorry over Bristol Harbour fee hike after warnings boat dwellers could be made homeless again. He was heckled in a public meeting, that is on Tuesday evening, after claiming some boat dwellers were privileged and abusing the system. People living and working in Bristol Harbour face huge fee increases from April. Well, what about this particular point, Mandy? Because the actual fee increases, what have they actually decided on Tuesday? Did they decide to go ahead with all this?
It got approved, yeah. And I think it's going to go to a full cabinet meeting within the next couple of weeks to get officially approved. But I think if Marvin wants it through, then he's got the power to put it through, hasn't he?
So he just decided on his own. So the only person you can really appeal to is Marvin himself. And in fact, we heard from one of the boaters who was doing that. He's saying, look, help, you know, because we could be about to lose our homes if you get your way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, during the cabinet meeting, Marvin did very kindly offer to continue the engagement process with us, because obviously there was a lot of people there. There was a lot of questions, a lot of statements, petition. There was a lot of support. So Marvin very kindly offered to continue this engagement process, and that's when he got heckled, because it hasn't even begun. There was an introductory meeting with an external consultancy firm 2 years ago, where I had a half an hour chat with someone just to introduce who I was, who my organisation was, and what we represented. That was an introductory meeting. The stakeholder engagement was to follow.
So the council are saying things like they want an extra £100 for supplying electric to boaters, and an extra £325 for the annual residential mooring.
What is that? That's my question. What is that new licence category, which is what a lot of people would like and would need in the harbour? What does that mean? Who is that for? Where's it going to be? Why, if the housing crisis, it's such a, everything that Bristol City Council does is, if they can relieve the housing crisis, they're going to mention it. It's in the blog. It's in the papers. If they can do anything to take this pressure off the housing market. And here we are with a new residential licence category. And there's no mention of actually increasing the housing capacity in the harbour on boats.
Nothing at all, no. In fact. And these fees, by the way, are not just... that doesn't sound too much, does it? £325 for annual residential mooring, but it's per metre.
Per metre per year.
Yeah.
My vessel is 20 metres long.
Okay, so that's
nearly £7,000.
Crikey.
That's if I'm lucky enough to even get one of those. So that's an inflation. Personally, I'm on a wall mooring at 130.
You know what I'd do is I'd get one of those. Is it Dutch barges that are really fat but quite short? That sounds like the way to get around this. I mean, it all sounds very arbitrary and actually quite cruel, Martin.
Yeah, Marvin's case saying that central government have cut off our money to the bone and all the rest of it. There's a strong case for that. I mean, that's why councils all over the country are struggling to resolve various issues because they just don't have the resources, and that's to do with austerity, Osborne, and all the rest of it. But what they haven't thought this through in terms of this is a safety valve for people who can't afford other kinds of housing.
Mm-hmm.
Same as the Conservative government criminalised squatting, which again was another safety valve for people who couldn't afford housing, and the same with moving van dwellers on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's more and more people in the United States, that home of freedom and democracy and the capitalism. Lots of people live in their cars and in tent cities because that is the way it's going. And it's almost like trying to stop the tide coming in to say that we're going to just get rid of all of this and gentrify it all, when in actual fact everything's moving in the opposite direction. Mm. I mean, even professional people can't afford to rent. So what are they going to do? You know, I imagine there will be people down there who are professionals,
mm-hmm.
working in professional jobs, and they can't afford to rent anywhere, so having a boat's the only way to do it.
Okay, Mandy, maybe you could just explain roughly how much someone like you has to pay a year in mooring fees and what these changes will mean.
So at the moment, there's a range of fees all right across the harbour, and with this new fee structure, they're trying to simplify that, which is... fair enough, because it is quite complicated. But you've got to understand the facilities that people can access are completely buried as well. Some people have got laundry rooms, toilet and shower facilities, proper waste disposal, a pontoon, security gate, keypad, parking, all this stuff. Some people have just got a wall, no water, no electric, and they're standardising all these fees. For me, on my mooring, it only goes up £20 per metre per year. That's fine. No, nobody I've spoke to is against paying more to contribute to making it a better place, because that's all everybody wants is improvements in facilities, because it is dire. But when you see some of the huge, it's like hundreds of percent increase.
Well, somebody in the meeting on Tuesday was saying 300%, three
yeah.
times more yeah. they'll have to pay.
Yeah.
Now, that you could be looking at, how much?
a boat of my size on a residential mooring will cost about £7,000. At the moment, it's about 2.5.
Right.
So that's 177% increase. That's if I'm lucky enough to get offered one of those, or if I can afford one of those.
Well, look, Green Councillor Annie Stafford Townsend, representing the Central Ward, says there'd be no consultation, no engagement, no equalities impact assessment, and what it means for those whose lives depend on the harbour. Well, I mean, it sounds to me like this is just an absolutely appalling thing to do to your own citizens, particularly mm-hmm. From a Labour mayor that doesn't seem to care. I mean, we've just had this changes in the clean air zone, which means that people who can afford to buy brand new diesels for £60,000 don't pay a penny. And now he's doing this to the boaters. You have to really kind of wonder what party he represents, if any. But anyway, look, what about, you know, thoughts of resisting this somehow? Because it may be that this is just going to get it imposed and boaters are going to be picked off one by one.
Yeah, well, that's why we've gotten together. I mean, we've got a really good sort of communication amongst the group. I've spoke to so many of the other stakeholders over the last few days, and everyone shares the main sort of couple of concerns, and then everyone's got their own sort of tangent on what it means for them individually. But we are all getting together, we're having meetings, we're mobilising, we're speaking to as many different people that we can that can help us, and no one is resistant to paying any more, but people would like a reasonable increase, enough warning so they can plan ahead. You know, 2 months just isn't enough, and they want to be consulted. The people on the water have got some really, really good ideas at how the harbour can make more money. Got tons of them, and how it can be a better place and more inclusive. They're not even giving us the window to listen to.
I mean, it sounds to me they've got somewhere between maybe 200, 300 to £1 million they're getting in from you guys. What have they been doing with that money that they've been getting in mooring fees over the last few years?
So a primary job of the Harbour Office, the Harbour Authority, is flood defence in the city. Yeah, that benefits a whole load of people. If it wasn't for
the Harbour Office... Yeah, not just you. You don't need to worry about that. If we get a flood, you just, you know, your boats just float upwards, don't they?
Yeah, but then I'd sink in the mud at low tide as well. So I'm very happy that they do a really good job of keeping the water levels where they should be. You know, that's a massive part of the Harbour Authority. You said about the fancy flats on the harbour side. That land would have been used as part of the docks estate for the warehouses, for the commercial shipping and all the goods that used to come on and off those vessels when it was a commercially trading harbour. And they would have paid taxes on the land. So I'm not sure about whether the boats on the harbour is what's always funded the harbour. I think it's the activity on the land which has contributed to keeping the harbour operational.
Well, it's also, just let me, sorry to interrupt you, but it's also what is really good for the value of these properties is that if the harbour is in a decent state, if it's all overgrown and messy and hasn't been cleaned out and that kind of thing, then the value of these luxury flats all around it starts to go down and down and down. So actually, by you paying to keep up for the upkeep of the harbour, you're actually helping out all these people in their £1 million luxury flats all around you.
Yeah, and I wouldn't just want to lump it onto the person in a £1 million flat. but it's the Bristol City Harbour is an asset for everyone. It's the biggest tourist thing we've got in the whole city. It's the most wonderful free day out if you can afford the ice cream in the expensive ice cream vans around the docks. It's a wonderful place that millions of people enjoy, and all we're seeing is a massive lump sum onto boat owners. That's the only thing we've got about how this place is going to improve, and it's just it's absolutely unbelievable.
Well, it isn't. I can tell you it's not unbelievable when you see some of the things that this mayor has gotten up to. In fact, some of the things, in fact, previous mayors, like, I remember sitting here talking about George Ferguson and his basically saying, we're not going to fund the St. Paul's Carnival unless all you lot get off the committee, all you West Indians from St. Paul's get off the committee, and I'm going to decide who's going to be on the committee. I remember that, being quite shocked that the council, you know, take that sort of attitude. Yeah, you've also got a by-election, I think, haven't you? Hot Wells and Harbourside by-election. I don't know if you guys get... Do you get to vote there, do you know?
Well, that is the problem of... So there's all these different boat users in the harbour. We've got people on leisure vessels and people that come and visit. They need good facilities on the land, okay, because they're on smaller boats and they use those sort of things. We've got residential licences, licence holders, big boats, proper houseboats. They've got an address, you know, and then we've got all these other people spending a lot of time on their other boats. They're all fully equipped as a residence, yeah? That doesn't give you a postbox, doesn't give you an address. A right to vote? No
really?
Chance.
This is awful, Martin. We've got hundreds of people in the city that don't have a right to vote.
If you're on a relatively permanent basis, you ought to get a right to vote, surely.
There is a right to vote. How do you access that?
Yeah, well, I suppose you're...
This is a tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
It's getting kids into schools, it's accessing your doctor, it's getting the social care. There's so many things which are hurdles for these, privileged few that live on boats. No.
One of the things that strikes me, actually, as you were talking, is that the whole council tax, which is another version of community charge poll tax, when we had the rating system, which was abolished by Margaret Thatcher, those wealthy People who live in the million-pound houses will be paying a hell of a lot more than they are now. And that was how things used to be funded. But we got rid of that, and it's all dumped onto the little people.
Well, that's right. The owners of the property used to pay the tax.
That's right. So there's no way to evade it. It was much easier to collect for the city council, because if you don't pay it, we just impound the building. What they actually spend a lot of time doing, I used to work with Bristol Debt Advice Centre, is chasing up people who owe council tax. And, of course, the amount of money they owe is trivial, and the amount of effort to try and squeeze it out of them is enormous. And, of course, it's a stupid way to fund things. They've still got the rating system in Northern Ireland, because it wasn't abolished. They didn't dare to do it. They did it first in Scotland. If you remember, they brought in the poll tax in Scotland. They did it deliberately there, because they knew there would be a lot of hostility to it, and they thought they could ride that out. But they didn't dare to introduce it in Northern Ireland, because it was still at the troubles were still going, and they realised that we can't send bailiffs down the Shankill Road or the Falls Road to collect people's televisions, because they're all going to end up dead. So they didn't do it, and that means that local government in Northern Ireland is still funded through the rates. And of course, we shouldn't have abolished the rates. No. There's lots of things we shouldn't have done, and then we think 20, 30 years later, you think, oh God,
but
how
then
did we
Tony
end up in this
Blair
place?
And Gordon Brown didn't reverse any of this, did
well,
they?
No, they couldn't have done that. They didn't even bother to revaluate, because all the houses are still valued at what they were in the 1990s,
anyway,
and they've
look,
not been valued up.
As an attempt to sort of sum up, Mandy, I'll leave the final word to you. You can talk for as long as you want about this, but I'd also like you, if you can and if you want to look at the sort of bigger picture, because we seem to be piling these extra fees, taxes, whatever, to pay for local authorities, for central government too in some ways, particularly local authorities, onto the people who can least afford to pay it. The tax burden seems to have shifted over to people with not much money. And actually, I remember I was chatting to him this week, Kevin Carhill, former Sunday Times journalist, on this programme, he used to be quite regularly. We'll have to get him on again soon. He came up with a terrific headline for the Sunday Times back in the 1980s. His article, which was a front page lead, "The Rich Pay No Tax." Now, we seem to be creeping towards that with this. But anyway, I'll just leave that, how do we fix the situation? Because it just seems to me that slowly but surely, more and more of the attempts to sort of, with Martin, we're just talking about council tax too, is falling on people who can least afford to pay it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where do I start?
It's a big question. Look, I know it's a massive question, but I mean, talk about you. If you could just talk about your own situation, and it may be easier to think like this. If you were in Marvin's situation, what would you be doing?
I would be meeting with these stakeholder groups and giving them the engagement and the consultation that they need over a reasonable period, and really get a grip on these different groups, what their constraints are, what the opportunities are, how can we help. Do you mean the businesses that operate in the harbour are family businesses, long-standing, hard-working
family
businesses.
But they're not very good at lobbying, are they?
No.
The big business is really good at lobbying, getting the ear of the powerful people.
They're surviving. They're just about surviving. And the impacts of these fees and charges at such a sudden and sort of drastic implementation are just going to wipe out a huge fraction of boat-based businesses in the harbour and the boat dwellers. And it's going to change the complete demographic. And what you see as a visitor coming down to Bristol City Docks, I believe if this comes into play in a couple of months' time, it is going to look very much different to what you see now.
It's going to be almost like a kind of Highland clearances in the harbour if we're not careful.
It'll be out with the old and in with the new. And it will be the newer boats that can afford those higher fees. It'll be the boats with the helicopters on the top. And we don't want to be like Portishead, as lovely as Portishead Marina is. Bristol isn't loved for that. It's loved for the diversity of vessels and these long-standing businesses and the faces that you see on the docks.
Well, I wonder if some of these decisions, Martin, are being made by people who have got maybe two or three boats in two or three harbours around the country that they maybe visit once a year.
Now you can see where it might end up. Where Bristol Harbour, it just becomes just for wealthy people, really, and other people just visiting occasionally and watch the wealthy people in their posh boats.
It's a very basic form, it seems to me, Mandy, of social cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that
yeah.
seems to be what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible for it to be going on anyway. How do people follow your story and keep in touch with what's going on here?
You can have a look on our website, which is bristolboaters.org. We are in the process of setting up a news page, and we've got a mailing list for anyone that's got a mooring in Bristol. Yeah, we've been busy doing lots of sort of face-to-face meetings. We're going to prepare for the next cabinet. We're really trying to sort of mobilise, and we just want a delay on this decision, so people have got time to talk, discuss, breathe. I'd really love Marvin's office and the Harbour office, Bristol City Council. We need to get in the room and discuss about the impacts on these people.
Well, I'm sorry, but my experience is he doesn't do things like that.
Well, can anyway. I just say that you have got an opportunity with this by-election, because it's actually very tight between the Liberal Democrats, the Greens and the Labour Party.
No, maybe. Well, Lib Dems and Greens.
Yes, no, but the Labour Party have still got 600 votes at stake here. That's what they got last time. And it is coming up, and this, I mean, things, people, they wanted to sell the library off to the Cathedral School. But the Labour Party activists knocking on the doors in Hotwells have found there's massive opposition to this, because people mm-hmm. use that library. Mm-hmm. And because they want to win the by-election, they're prepared to reconsider the decision. I mean, this is how it's supposed to work. Mm. Now, when you say you haven't got the votes there because you're not all on votes, okay, but never mind, the community around you mm-hmm. have got votes. And it's an opportunity, you know, that's the only thing that politicians actually listen
to. Let's hope that they can get that community mobilised and do something about this. It's quite obvious. It seems like a David and Goliath
type struggle. I can imagine the Greens would pick this up.
Yeah, they've come to a few of our meetings already, including Patrick McAllister came along with Annie Stafford Townsend.
Well,
they've been to a few of our meetings and they are really, really supportive.
Well, it seems like a no-brainer to me for anyone that wants to push the Labour Party and Marvin Rees out of the city. Anyway, Mandy Sharman from the Bristol, what is it, community?
Bristol Boaters Community Association.
Do you want to just give your website again, finally?
It's bristolboaters.org.
Thank you ever so much for coming in and sharing all that with us. Fascinating conversation, and more power to your elbow, or to your oars, or whatever it is you use to get around. Actually, have people got engines? Could they just move out of the city if they needed to, most people?
Yeah, of course they can. But the sort of gridlock up the river and the waiting lists in the marinas it's a pressurised sort of system to be in. My vessel's been there for 20 years on an annual licence. You know, my vessel's quite happy being in the city. I've set up roots in the city alongside many, many other people.
Well, it's a great place to be, except when people do things like this. So, anyway, Mandy, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin, we're now going to have a listen to an interesting, I thought, and it's a sort of related topic, a guy called James Perry from Ethical Millionaires, if you can believe such a thing exists. He says that the tax burden in this country is falling on all the wrong people. You can imagine that from a millionaire.
So we're a group of wealth holders who are making the point that the tax system is imbalanced because it puts too much burden on working people and work and doesn't tap this vast pool of wealth which has accrued over the last few years.
Okay, so how much money have you given yourself that you shouldn't, that you weren't originally asked to give?
Well, so tax isn't voluntary. So I would distinguish between fat tax and philanthropy. The point about tax is it's a systemic intervention to fund hospitals, schools, the things that the democracy decides that it wants provided for it. So philanthropy is not a solution to this. We need the tax system to look at all of the different sources of revenue and tax them fairly for everybody. Okay, well, starting at the beginning, I think the first point is that tax is a contribution to a functioning society. You know, we all want to be in it together. We want a society that's working, and we can all see the disintegration of public services right now. And we have a taxation system which looks to income. So it looks to working people to fund those public services. And what it ignores is the fact that over the last several years, decades, new wealth, when it's created, has accrued pretty much to the wealthy. So two-thirds of new wealth created in the last 2 years has gone to the top 1%. So I think what people don't realize is that when you look at the kind of wealth distribution over the sort of from the poorest 1% to the richest 1%, when you get to the top 1%, you actually get down to the top 0.1%, and you see this new wealth creation drifts like snow into the hands of these extremely wealthy people, and then isn't touched by the tax system. And because the tax system is focused on the 99%, who are really squeezed and undergoing this cost of living crisis, that's why the state can't afford to provide the services it needs, because it's just not touching this extreme wealth, which is a modern phenomenon. The tax system actually incentivizes people, not wealthy people, not to pay tax. You know, it offers a non-dom status, for example, where people can offshore their assets and not pay tax on them. So the tax system, for example, has a lower marginal taxation rate for income that comes from capital, from saving capital, than it does from work. So it already favors the wealthy in terms of its structural design. So that's the first point. And the second point is with respect to avoidance. You know, your assets have your name on them. You know, they are traceable. So this idea that people can ferret away their assets into under the sofa and the tax man can't find them is really not true.
But it's not necessarily about the tax man not finding them. It's about saying, well, I'm going to register my company in Switzerland, for example, where tax is lower, or I'm going to move to a different country where, or I'm going to base myself for tax purposes in a different country, surely.
Yeah, look, I think that there are people out there who are of that mindset, but I don't think they're in the majority. I think you'll find most people of wealth are rooted in community. Their children are being educated in British schools. They love Britain. They're here because they want to be here. And this idea that they can just up sticks and move to the Cayman Islands when the Revenue Service wants to take not an unreasonable amount of money off them. You know, they're going to still be left with substantial wealth. No one's talking about confiscation. We're talking about, for example, our group is talking about taxing 1% of wealth over £10 million. You know, these people are still going to be okay. But even 1% of wealth over £10 million results in a massive tax take because these drifts of wealth that have accrued over the last years are just so massive.
James Perry there, from Ethical Millionaires, if you can believe that. Martin, actually, we do like to sort of characterise wealthy people as just selfish. It seems some of them are saying, well, look, this is, I thought, a fascinating interview where he's saying we shouldn't be taxing income for workers. We should only be taxing people who are getting massive income, and we should be taxing assets.
Well, income tax was only created during the Napoleonic Wars, and before that it didn't exist, and it was only, even when it came in, it was only supposed to be wealthy people who paid it. So the fact that workers pay income tax is in fact a relatively recent phenomenon. I think the point was very well made that capital gains are taxed at a lower level than income, which is absurd, because if people do create wealth as entrepreneurs or workers, you don't want to discourage them. But capital gains is wealth that's come to you through no work that you've put in. It's the price of your house rising in value, or that your shares rising in value, and you've done nothing for that you've done nothing for that. Yeah, that money should be the most easily taxed. And as he says, it's quite easy to trace assets. And he was saying, well, most people wouldn't head off to the Cayman Islands. I've got a simple answer to that. If you don't pay your taxes in Britain, if you live in Britain, you've got to pay it. Whether you're a non-dom and you come here, like Rishi Sunak's wife, you should have to pay your taxes. And if you're a British citizen, it doesn't matter where you live in the world, we expect you to pay your British taxes. So if you go to live in, you know, go to live in the Cayman Islands, you're still going to have to pay. And it's quite a straightforward thing to do, isn't it? If you're, I mean, now of course companies can then move around their headquarters, you know, like Dublin's got masses and masses of multinational companies based there because the tax rate on business profits is ridiculously low. But I think wealth, you know, private wealth is easily taxable. And if you go back to the Middle Ages, they didn't have income taxes, they had wealth taxes. And the wealthy would be charged, you know, we're going to have a 15th to pay for the Hundred Years' War. That means you've got to sell a 15th of your stuff and pay us what we think your stuff is worth. And so it was actually quite common for the wealthy to pay taxes on their wealth. And it's in many ways the most straightforward way for the government to raise money.
Patrioticmillionaires.uk, they're called. Are you going to join them, Martin?
Well, I'd have to be a millionaire first, wouldn't I?
Well, I'm not sure you actually do. They're always looking for new members, they say, to build their organisation.
Well, perhaps they could make me a millionaire, and then I'd gladly
join. If you are a millionaire who would like to, maybe you could be part of one of their tax-dodging schemes and get some money.
I think this, you know, this has always been the case that some wealthy people feel an obligation to the rest of society. But, of course, there are others who don't, you know. Well, Semyon Mogilevich, the head of the Russian mafia, doesn't feel as if he owes anybody anything.
Quite sweet. At the bottom of the page, right down, you know, the dregs of the page, they say, if you're not a millionaire, but I'm keen to stay informed about what we do, please subscribe and we will keep you informed about our progress. But, I mean, I suppose what I'm saying here is that I'm quite amazed that, you know, they're not... there are people out there. What's the agenda here, do you think?
Well, I mean, let's not be too negative. It's genuine. You know, some people look around and they say, gosh, life's been quite kind to me. Why am I, you know, what sort of person am I? And, of course, the lady that was criticising Rishi Sunak earlier, there's also a feeling that what may happen if this concentration of wealth continues is people are going to say, well, why can't we live in a country like Cuba where there are no millionaires?
Well, they talk about, you know? They've got some of the people they've got on their website is Dr. Phil White, Christina Johansson, Graham Hobson, James Perry, you just heard there, Julia Davis, Gemma McGough, Gary Stevenson. Now, looking at their profiles, they seem to be mostly people in somewhere or other who's kind of fallen into the situation where they've realised, well, either they've inherited a business or their business has done particularly well, or they've gone into doing some sort of hedge fund business, which has done really well. But they're people who have stumbled into this world and they've just gobsmacked at the fact that everything seems to set up. I think he talked about that money drifts like snow towards us and the whole system seems to be set up.
No, but what he was saying, the money drifts like snow to the 0.1% at the very top of the pile. And of course, if they could be properly taxed, then you could reduce taxes on the middle earners and on the poor. I mean, there's no case really from, I mean, I get paid universal credit, but I still have to pay tax on my PAYE earnings. So the government gives me money with one hand and takes it away with another. You could take loads of people out of the tax system altogether if they're on low incomes. We need to have taxes on wealth and property because they're easy to collect. And of course, it's a straight, and the way to get round it, or they're all going to go to the Cayman Islands or whatever, you just say, no, it doesn't matter where you go. If you want to retain your British citizenship and your right of residence, you must pay all the taxes that we think you owe.
But how is this actually going to happen? Because Starmer's not going to do anything about this, is he?
Well, he's going to do, what he's promised is he's going to tax non-doms and so on. So in other words, what the Labour Party are doing now is they're saying we're going to take some steps in that sort of direction. And in any case, it's us or the Tories. So, you know, you've got to suck it up. But of course, if there is a big crash in capitalism, which I keep predicting, and it probably will happen, people are going to raise the issue of, if my kids can't find anywhere to live, then we really demand that the government does something to help us.
Okay,
and you're going to have to find the money from somewhere.
Zip through a few stories before the break and before we look at Scott Ritter and Ukraine. Prime Minister's questions again.
Olivia Blake.
Mr. Speaker, from Rwanda to deaths in the Channel and the latest scandal of missing children, refugees and campaigners have today gathered outside Parliament to highlight the impact of the hostile environment on people in the migration and asylum system. Rather than cruel gimmicks like Rwanda, isn't the best way of deterring Channel crossings, saving lives and breaking the business model of criminal gangs to introduce safe and legal routes to claim asylum?
Well, Mr. Speaker, this just is about fairness. It's about fairness for those that seek to come here legally. It's about fairness for those who are here and our ability to integrate and support those who we want to. What we will do is break the cycle of criminal gangs, which are causing untold misery, leading to deaths in the Channel. And that's why we will introduce legislation that makes it clear that if you come here illegally, we will be able to detain you and swiftly remove you to a safe third country. That is the reasonable and common sense approach that the vast majority of the British public supports.
So our glorious Prime Minister completely ducked the question about these vulnerable children who disappeared, Martin, didn't he?
Well, the question wasn't about the vulnerable children.
Well, that was part of the question.
All right. Well, I mean, the reason why people come here to claim asylum and cross the Channel in small boats is because the rules are that you cannot claim asylum in a country unless you are physically in that country. And that's why they do it. And if you want to get...
The reason they do it is because there is a criminal organisation which brings them here.
No, Lots of these people that get into these boats in France have arrived there because they've paid people traffickers to get them there, but they're getting the boats themselves. Now, the fact is, they could easily do this.
They're not getting in the boat for free, are they?
No, Tony. They tend to be the middle class from countries that we've invaded, Iraq and Afghanistan.
There was a story today saying that the criminal gangs that are bringing them over are one of the most successful companies in Europe. They've made millions.
Yes. And of course, if you want to have an asylum system that works, you've got to actually say to people when.
And you are also now dodging the question, which is I asked you about the kids disappearing.
Well, I don't know where they've disappeared, and I don't know whether they're all Albanians. I don't know anything about it.
The Observer has done an investigation into it. 136 children who stayed in the hotel in. In Brighton over the last 18 months have gone missing, 136 of them. An Observer investigation has revealed that 79 children, over half of those missing, remain unaccounted for. They're literally being picked up from outside the building, disappearing and never being found.
Well, that's shocking, isn't it? But the whole system of a climbing asylum is broken because people should be able to claim without putting foot on British soil.
So what's going on?
You
can
process their asylum claims before they come.
You know, you're disappearing off into another story. What's happening to these kids? What do you think?
I don't know, Tony. It's quite likely that they've been taken off to be put into prostitution or crime. That's the most likely thing, isn't it?
The Home Office has been warned that asylum-seeking children would be targeted by gangs.
Yes, they're probably working in brothels.
A total dereliction of duty for the Home Office to so badly fail to protect child safety or crime. I mean, there's all this talk about child safety, isn't there? We get lots and lots and lots of stuff about that. Oh, we've got to do it for the love of the children. Actually, they don't really care, do they?
Well, there's always been the case that 200 children in this country die at the hands of their carers, something like that, every year. Thousands of them are injured. And it's only when a big case comes up that people go, gosh, what's going on about that?
At the end of the article I've got here about it, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, it says Sussex Police were contacted for comment. That's all. No reply.
No, because they presumably don't know anything about it.
They presumably haven't investigated it.
No. And
maybe they're in the middle of an investigation, or maybe they're being bribed by the same gangs who are taking the kids.
No, it's more likely that it's just not on their list of priorities. Dealing with burglary for the wealthy people of Surrey is probably more important to them than looking after foreign children.
Sussex, yes. Actually.
Yeah.
But anyway, last week I spoke to John Wedger, who's Metropolitan Detective, Metropolitan Police, and he explained to me I don't know if anyone listened to the whole interview with him, but I think it's worth just bringing out this little 4-minute clip, which we didn't play last week, which really explains. John says one of the first things they were taught how to do when he joined the police was how to lie.
I have confidence in Mark Rowley, I do. Questioned it, none whatsoever. I mean, she even denied being in a meeting when it was meant to be a one-to-one meeting with her. I was with a colleague and I told her exactly what was happening with these children. And then she went on to deny it. Yet I produced, evidence, with her endorsing it on emails that I was in this meeting and these things were discussed. So, they will lie. They will cover up for each other. And like this guy said to me, again, he went on to become one of the UK's most senior police officers. And he said, if you ever expect myself and others to betray rank, you're mistaken. It isn't going to happen. So they are not going to go against rank. It's not going to happen. Why, I don't know. I mean, even to the point when they are summoned on a parliamentary level to account for their actions, they don't play ball. In respect to my case, the Cabinet Minister for Policing and Crime summons Cressida Dick to account for herself in Parliament, and she just simply didn't bother turning up. And the City of London Police aren't even accountable to Parliament or the Crown. So, that's another world in its own right. But they will clamp down. And the one thing you are guaranteed that officers will do when they're in trouble, and I'm telling you now, they will lie. Right? The first lesson you're taught when you're a police officer is how to give a false evidence, bear false witness. That's the first thing you're told. And if you're not prepared to do it, you ain't going to be trusted at all. And that's definitely within the CID. It might have changed, but it looks like standards have got worse. They haven't got any better. But, you know, they are quite happy in lying. They're quite happy holding a Bible in their hand and lying. They're quite happy looking a judge in the eyes and lying. So don't think because they're holding a Bible, they've got a uniform or they've got a warrant card, they're going to tell the truth. No, they're not. And that's not just the police. The social services will do it. The medical industry will do it. They will all lie to protect ultimately themselves, but also their colleagues. So God bless anyone who stands up against that culture.
Well, that's amazing. So what do you make of Suella Braverman? Does the Home Secretary really have that much power? Maybe she's been involved in this outing this guy.
Well, I mean, the Home Secretary, they've all got answers to the Home Secretary, ultimately. But what's the Home Secretary going to say? You know, didn't they say the same thing about Wayne Cousins? And when was that? A year and a half ago? He was sentenced a year ago? I mean, they said exactly the same thing. And then in the same OQ command, almost the same modus operandi, we get this other maggot doing the same thing. I mean, they're a carbon copy of what has changed. I mean, what Rowley's saying is there will be vetting. Well, it should have been done in the first place. There should have been vetting. There should have been psychometric testing to identify this level of deviance. It wouldn't be difficult to do. They can task any sort of trick cyclist to put a package together, you know, and psychometrically evaluate these people properly and get them out. But no, they decided, look, the public gets what the public wants. You know, no one kicked off when the police lowered their standards. And of course, these are people that are going to police you. And what they're going to do, you know, they're going to fail you. So you must have standards. I mean, when you get like the military, you know, you get these elite units, they never drop their standards because they have to. They realise if they drop their standards, there's a problem. Yet the police are doing it all the time.
So that's John Wedger there. Spoke to him last week, ex-detective, Constable Martin. He's really painting a picture of a pretty awful culture in the police where actually keeping your job, protecting your colleagues is far more important than telling the truth.
Well, that may be so, but I think he's a bit naive if he imagines that British special forces don't tell lies as well. I mean, the British SAS are accused at the moment of assassinating 157 civilians in cold blood in Afghanistan.
I know the SAS are not your favourite people, but I don't think he was saying that. He was saying that, what you were saying there was that they lowered their standards for a load of recruitment around about 2010... for the police, or maybe it was around about 2000, and that as a result, these criminals came in and became police officers. Now, obviously, they were potential criminals. I don't know if they've been previous criminals, but he's saying that if you're in a fighting force, then you're simply not going to be able to fight if you have a load of people that can't fight in that force.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that the police, army, and intelligence services were all but put above the law by this Tory government. There's going to be a problem with insiders protecting each other's backs in anything. As he said, it happens in the medical profession, it happens in social services, and it no doubt happens amongst bankers. Well, Can you imagine that?
He may be right about all Mark Rowley.
Covering their own
backs.
He
may be right about Mark Rowley, though, because Rowley has said this week in the Telegraph and other papers, two or three Metropolitan Police officers who appear in court charged with crimes every week. Rowley's warning that a clean-up of the force will unearth yet more ghastly cases. Speaking at the London Assembly's Police and Crime Committee, he apologised for the failings that allow serial rapist David Carrick to carry on serving as an officer. He shouldn't have been a police officer, and we have failed, Mark said. He's saying that more ghastly cases are coming up.
Well, I think that's good news to hear. And, and I'm also, I have sympathy for people in his position who are trying to keep the organisation on the straight and narrow. In Northern Ireland, the disbanding of the Royal Ulster Constabulary and its reconstitution as the police service of Northern Ireland has actually been quite a success. And of course, we don't want to boast too much because, you know, at some point it'll become clear that they also have been involved in some kind of skullduggery. But they've certainly got a lot more respect on the in the nationalist community than the RUC ever had. And that shows that things can improve, provided the people in charge have got the right sort of attitude.
Have they?
Well, I don't know, Tony. In Northern Ireland, everybody seems to be more happy with the situation than they were 20 years ago. When, in actual fact, on the Republican side, they were quite happy to see police officers killed, but there was some, you know, there was some sympathy for all soldiers who got killed because they felt that they weren't really to blame. But police officers, no problem at all. We want them dead. That's changed, and that's good.
Are you sure?
I think it has, Tony. When was the last police officer assassinated in Northern Ireland?
Maybe
quite a long time ago.
Yeah,
and hundreds of them were assassinated before that because they weren't accepted in the nationalist community.
Anyway, it's interesting to see that we're being told actually we've got a whole load of crooked cops we're getting rid of. Maybe this has been a problem that's been stewing away for 30 years.
It's a problem that's always been there. Yeah,
probably in the same in all aspects of public service.
That's
really.
Right.
Finally, before the break, Ghislaine Maxwell. She did an interview with Jeremy Kyle on Talk Radio on Monday, where she talks about Prince Andrew and all this whole business of did he sleep with this Victoria lady, Virginia. Anyway, let's have a quick extract from that.
This must be one of the most infamous photographs in recent memory, and it has done Prince Andrew and the royal family extraordinary reputational harm. Let's hear what Ghislaine Maxwell has to say about it.
It's a fake. I don't believe that. I don't believe it's real for a second. In fact, I'm sure it's not. There's never been an original. And further, there's no photograph. And I've only ever seen a photocopy of it. I don't believe it happened. And certainly the way as described would have been impossible. I don't have any memory of going to tramp. Certainly not in the outfit that I would have worn. Her stories have changed so many times about what happens, when it happens, how it happens, with different versions. And each time she speaks, there's a different version. In fact, if you look at her BBC interview on the panorama, I believe she says that he puked on her face. That's the only time she's ever said that.
In a separate interview recorded as audio only, Maxwell also launched a blistering attack on the integrity of Andrew's accuser, Virginia Giuffre.
I've read a lot of her deposition, and in her deposition, her statements are very categorical and her stories are very detailed and elaborate. If her memory is so poor, then how can you rely on anything that she says? I don't know on which it is. Either her memory is so bad that you can't really credit anything she says, or it's more disingenuous than that. I can't obviously tell you which it is, only she knows definitively the answer to that. You know, and like I said, I think once you retract on two men that you make claims against on the grounds that your memory is faulty, like I said, I think that, you know, you have to question everything that she says.
So that's Ghislaine Maxwell speaking to Jeremy Kyle and another interview that he used on his programme on Monday this week. So the obvious question is, why didn't Andrew contest the photo? Maybe Ghislaine is just lying.
This is proper gender in that we're all talking about this in relation to Prince Andrew and whether he did or didn't do things, rather than Epstein and Maxwell being Mossad agents and blackmailing everybody at the top. We're talking a hell of a lot about Ghislaine Maxwell. What about the guys who were having sex with the girls that she was providing? Why don't we hear about them? Clinton, Trump, and all these other
people.
They're
sitting on a hard drive over in Tel Aviv.
Well, that's right. And, of course, by concentrating on the Andrew side of the story, it's a way of Mossad pushing the whole real meat of this story into the long grass. And
Well, he's actually, I mean, let's just be absolutely clear about this. He is a scapegoat. And yes, everybody yes. else who's been in
right.
been in that little circle, slept with this woman, etc., who, you know, she's a victim, and she was effectively a prostitute. She was victimised and brought into that whole situation. And everybody who slept with her was also a victim. So it's interesting to hear, I think, Max. I mean, she said something there very weird, which was about, oh, the top I was wearing wasn't the top I'd normally wear. And it was all just been fixed. Now, just looking at the photo, Virginia, Prince Andrew, and Ghislaine Maxwell all seem to be wearing quite similar. I mean, it's all these kind of white clothes they're wearing. Sleeveless, the two ladies. It doesn't seem as if it's anything particularly weird about what she's wearing at all. She's saying, oh, I can tell you honestly, I wouldn't wear something like that. Well, I'm not sure I believe her.
Well, no, she's an accomplished liar and quite possibly an intelligence agent. And, of course, one of the things she's doing by standing up for Prince Andrew is she's trying to flag up, come on, let me off, people. You know, I'm one of yours. And, of course, the real story here is that what was going on there with the island and all the rest of it is that Mossad were blackmailing all the top politicians and billionaires, Bill Gates, all of them were going and having sex with underage girls, and it was all being filmed and photographed. That's the story. And that means, of course, that when the Israelis attack Iran in the next 6 months, that nobody in the West will challenge them because, well, you can't really if they've got all those photographs.
1982. The Clash with Rock the Casbah, gorgeous song. In fact, almost everything the Clash did, wasn't it brilliant? Seems to be banned from the BBC and most other radio stations now. We maybe hear it occasionally. I don't hear that stuff.
You do it on Six Music.
Six Music, okay. Yeah. I don't really have Six Music on hardly at all. But anyway, so not on anything like Radio 2, no.
Oh, no, because it's...
Or local radio. This is the thing. I remember working in local radio. The older presenters would tell me, well, actually, when we first started, and it all changed. They could choose their own songs they played. And then it all changed around about 1990. And they used to get a little computer printout of what they were allowed to play. Some presenters left the BBC and joined commercial radio for that reason, because they just will say, well, who the hell do you think you are telling us what music we can play? But then, of course, there are sort of sycophants and egotists who will carry on doing it and go, just play any old nonsense that some computer tells them to play. And before that, we had 1968, The Doors, Strange Days. And at the very start, St. Mary's Church in Hitchin, Let All the World, Every Corner Sing, My God and King. So that was today's little musical break. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the new talkradio.org.uk stream, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. So we start straight away with the tanks, Martin, the tanks. I texted you during the week, the tanks. The yeah. Challenger tanks, the Leopard tanks, the Abrams tanks.
Yeah.
Now, looking at the numbers, it's probably a brigade of tanks that they're sending. That's what they want.
Well, what's striking about this is how divorced from the reality of what's been happening it is. They're talking about maybe being able to send these tanks, and they're rowing amongst themselves about sending
them. They are sending them.
I know, but the thing is, they can't send them in any timescale that's going to make any difference on the battlefield. And, of course, the numbers they are sending are nothing compared to the tanks that have been destroyed already in this horrendous conflict that's been going on over the last year. And it's
questions arising, things like, will the Ukrainians get the depleted uranium ammunition?
Well, that's what the Russians have been saying. If you use depleted uranium ammunition within territory which we regard as the Russian Federation, we might regard that as a nuclear attack on our territory. Okay? So they've not thought any of this through.
They don't care.
No, they don't care. The people pushing all of this are not just dangerous, but they're also stupid.
Are they armchair generals? That's what it strikes me.
Well, of course they are.
Put a few more tanks on there, and then we can win.
Yes, exactly. It's just absurd. There's no way that the Russians are going to lose this. They were never going to lose it. What happened this time last year was that Zelensky was shocked into negotiating with the Russians. And the Russians were happy to negotiate with him, because they've been saying that for 8 years. Why don't you negotiate with the rebels? That's what you agreed in 2014 and 2015. But they didn't bother to do it, because they were being encouraged all the time by the West to fight to the finish. Because the people behind this in the West, and that includes our government, see this as an opportunity to have a go at the Russians rather than a problem to be resolved.
Why?
Because Russia represents a threat to the world order managed by the West since the 15th century. And they've always been problematic. Don't forget that we went to war in the Crimea in the 1850s. What was that about? What was Britain's interest in invading the Crimea in 1850? You can ask Ben Wallace, our Defence Secretary, because he used to be in the Scots Guards, and he said, we kicked their backsides in the 1850s and we can do it again. I'm a Scots Guard. And you just think, you're in charge. This is really, really not very good, is it, when you've got people like that coming out with stuff like that? How out of touch they are with reality.
The Kremlin is saying that NATO's direct involvement in Ukraine war is growing. A former advisor to Putin says Russia could retaliate against NATO countries for sending tanks to Ukraine. This is a fantastic guy. Love him to bits. Dave DeCamp, antiwar.com. The Kremlin said on Thursday that its US and NATO's direct involvement in the war in Ukraine is growing, and the Western powers are pledging to send tanks and other equipment. There have been repeated statements from the European capitals and from Washington sending of various weapon systems, including tanks, to Ukraine, by no means signifies the involvement of these countries or the alliance in the hostilities.
Well,
Dmitry Peskov said, "We strongly disagree with this. Moscow perceives everything that both the alliance and the capitals I mentioned have been doing as direct involvement in the conflict. We see that it is growing."
Well, somebody blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, and the Russians are saying it was the Royal Navy. Maybe
it might be the Ukrainians, mightn't it?
Well, if it was the Ukrainians, we would be indirectly involved, but it looks like it was the Royal Navy. The Russians are accusing the Royal Navy of doing that, I'm afraid, and they've got ways of finding these things out. That's what they are saying. And, of course, that's just Russian disinfo, according to the Western powers. I mean, who else would blow up the Russians' pipeline? It's not the Russians who blow up their pipeline, is it? And Sikorsky, who was the former foreign minister in Poland, said, "Thank you, USA, for blowing up the pipeline." But the Russians said it wasn't the USA, it was the Brits, on behalf of the USA. And Britain has played a particularly pernicious role in stoking the conflict in the Ukraine. And if there is blowback on British soil, people should think very hard about how we got into that situation.
OK, well, let's look at all this. First of all, with Prime Minister's questions.
Dr. Liam Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Innocent civilians are being murdered in Ukraine on Putin's orders as we speak. And as we see in a warmed House of Commons, families are freezing because their electricity is being cut off by Russian forces. Putin believes that Ukraine is more important to him than the free world and is moving to a full war footing. So the Ukrainians must make gains on the battlefield, and the next 6 months are crucial. They need a full range of weapons, Mr. Speaker, air defence, artillery, longer range missiles and tanks, and enough to make a real difference. The UK has shown great leadership on this issue. Can I ask, therefore, my right honourable friend to use every means at his disposal, domestic and international, to honour the courage of the people of Ukraine and to defend the whole world order, because ultimately that is what we're really talking about.
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've made clear that the UK and our allies must accelerate our efforts to ensure Ukraine wins this war and secures a lasting peace. Last year, the United Kingdom provided £2.3 billion in military aid to Ukraine, the largest package of support of any European nation, and we will at least match that again this year. And as my right honourable friend knows, last week I announced that we would gift many battle tanks as part of the next major package of UK support to Ukraine, and I'm pleased that our friends and allies are preparing to follow our lead.
Well, the level of delusion about all of this just makes me despair. The Challenger battle tanks are unusable by the Ukrainians without being trained on them, because they're not trained to use them. So in actual fact, it's just a lot of posturing. There's no air superiority, so they're going to be totally vulnerable to Russian missile and aircraft attack. And there's no hope whatever that they're going to win when the Russians have taken over the 20% of the Ukraine that they claimed in the first place, which has been claimed because there was a referendum in 2014 where all these regions voted to leave the Ukraine. And of course, Kosovo didn't even vote to leave Yugoslavia, but they left anyway. The Serbs in the Krajina in the 90s, they'd been living there for 1,000 years, but they were ethnically cleansed out of the Krajina by the Croatian forces supported by NATO. And this is just normal stuff. It's the kind, there's all of these conflicts all across Eastern Europe, which caused the First World War and the Second World War. And this is just a continuation of those conflicts. And the idea that the only civilians that have died have been killed by the Russians is absurd. The Ukrainians kill 14,000 Russian-speaking civilians in those Donbass republics by indiscriminate shelling. Poroshenko, the former president of the Ukraine, said, "Our children will enjoy kindergarten, their children will live in cellars." That's what he said. And that's exactly what they did. They shelled Donetsk and Luhansk and killed loads of civilians. And eventually the Russians lost patience. We went to war with Argentina in the Falklands. They hadn't killed a single British civilian, but we weren't having them taking over our territory. The same is true in Russia. The population within Russia proper and within the regions that speak Russian in the eastern part of the country, they are determined to fight to the finish because they see their own people being killed by our forces.
Let's take a step back from this a minute. These tanks were built and designed, the American ones, the German ones, and the British ones, to fight the Soviet Union. I mean, they're modern versions of those tanks.
Yeah.
They never had to fight. Surely this is a great opportunity for them to see, you know, how well are these going to perform if we have to have a war?
Well, as the Russians...
I'm telling you, it's almost like a kind of test bed. But the Ukrainians will obviously be sitting in those tanks. So when the Russians destroy them, no British, German, or American troops will be killed.
Don't be so sure about that. I think that the Ukrainians will not be able to be trained up in the timescale available. Therefore, NATO personnel with Ukrainian uniforms will be sitting in those tanks.
Maybe. But, I mean, surely the idea is that we get a whole bunch of hapless Ukrainian soldiers to sit in our tanks, get blown up and see how they perform.
Well, the Russians have already shown what's going to happen. They've completely degraded the Ukrainian army's tank force, and these tanks will turn up in dribs and drabs. And don't forget, there's all sorts of different.
Hang on, tanks. Because they may well decide that they want to deploy them on the battlefield all in one go as a spearhead force to cut right into the Russians and behind their lines.
Yeah, but this really is
maybe to retake
armchair generalship by people like Liam Fox, isn't it? We're going to hear from Scott Ritter in a minute, who's a real soldier. He will explain to them why there's two things wrong in war. Just war theory has two aspects to it. You've got to have a just cause. And secondly, you've got to have a realistic plan. Because if you fight without a realistic plan, even if your cause is just, you're in the wrong. Now, there's no realism in any of this apart from a protracted war to bleed the Russian Federation economically and in terms of political support for the government. Neither of which has worked. The war has actually solidified support behind United Russia in Russia. It's pretty clear. And any of the other parties in the Russian Duma, and there was an election just over a year ago, so you can see clearly who the Russian people support. All the other parties in the Duma have got a more militant attitude than United Russia.
Okay, so there's
as
also,
far as they're concerned, this is Russian territory, we're the invaders, and we should back off.
What do you think is the most likely answer to the depleted uranium question? This is something that I've not heard talked about on mainstream press at all. The Russians are going, we know you used EU shells in these tanks. If you start using them over here, we're going to get very annoyed because this stuff, pollutes the environment. We're going to have a hell of a cleanup operation. It spreads radioactivity all over the place. We're not having it.
Well, the obvious thing for them to do, and this is what they might do, is attack the tanks before they even arrive in the Ukraine. So they'll have to park them up in Poland, and then they're just going to be killed in Poland. And then we'll say, this is an attack on NATO, we're going to war. But NATO, as Scott Ritter will point out, when we invaded Iraq in 2003, it took months and months and months to assemble the force to do it. When we fought in the Falklands, it took months and months and months to assemble the force to do it. The Russians are already there in the field, ready to go. And as these dribs and drabs of people turn up to fight them, they're going to kill them. That's what they've been doing all along for a whole year. And they keep saying, why didn't you negotiate with us? Why didn't you negotiate with us? Zelensky was prepared to negotiate, and then Boris Johnson turned up and said, no negotiation.
Well, what about
that's why we're still fighting.
What about the politics of all this? Because it's fascinating, I think, seeing the German defence minister, or whoever he is, being very, very taciturn. He did a press conference, I don't know if you saw it, with Stoltenberg, and he hardly said anything. He was just sort of, you know, I don't want to say. It does look to me as if the Americans have lent on the Germans and said, look, we can't really be seen to be handing all these tanks over to the Ukrainians from America. We need to make sure that it's seen to be that the Europeans are the first to do it, and we will then follow
suit.
But
you will notice that the Germans got the Americans to admit that they were going to send the Abrams battle tanks, and then they agreed to send their Leopards. Now, don't forget that the Germans are being deindustrialized by the taking out of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. That was the British who did that. If I was a German, and of course there are Germans who know this, Wagenknecht, who's in the Die Linke Partei, Schroeder, who used to be the SPD Chancellor, and Oscar Lafontaine, who used to be in SPD and now in the Links Partei, I would be saying, if we can show that the Royal Navy blew up that pipeline, which is a joint project between Russia and Germany.
Well, it may have been a joint project. Well, okay, the blowing up of it may have, the Royal Navy may have helped, and the Danish Navy might have helped.
Yes, but the Russians have already pointed the finger, okay?
Well, they may have their own reasons for doing that.
They may have their own reasons for doing it, not least because the British, the Germans and the French supposedly underpin the Minsk agreements.
I mean, the British, the Russians
and
may well...
And then Hollande and Merkel have blown the whistle. Well, we were only pretending to make peace because we wanted the Ukrainians to build up the forces to do... So, in other words, they've made it absolutely clear there's no point negotiating. France and Germany have no agency. The British and the Americans are going to push this war forward.
Well, Germany do. They certainly have this week, haven't they? By approving the sending of these tanks.
The sending of these tanks, if you look at public opinion in Germany, they're very, very dubious about all of this. But they're sending the tanks because actually Germany is still occupied. It's occupied by the United States and Britain. And they are going to do, they're going to basically commit national suicide for a totally illusory goal. The idea that we're going to have a... And, of course, they've also been told that they can't do deals with China.
Well, it's interesting.
So Germany's best customers is China, yeah. And they get they're the best customers of Russia. They're going to be wiped out economically by this.
The Germans and the Americans getting together to make these decisions in a press conference with Stoltenberg and the German guy... this is starting to look... I mean, there's quite a lot of Nazis went to the United States, weren't there?
Yes, I know, but don't just see it as... there's quite a lot of sentiment. The alternative for Germany people were saying in the Bundestag that, you know, we're not happy about seeing Leopard tanks going to the Ukraine. I mean, how does that... We can see that what the Germans are being forced to do is burn their bridges with the Russians. And they don't know what to do about it, actually, because their testicles are in the vice. They're not in a position to argue. They should argue. Baerbock, who's the Green foreign minister, said, let's face it, we are, and she was on the record of saying that this week, let's face it, we're at war with Russia. Now, if you say you're at war with Russia, then Russia say, okay, we're at war with you, Germany. Right. Are you ready for some missiles on German territory? If you're going to send these tanks from Germany through Poland into Ukraine to kill Russian soldiers, we're not going to let them get the Ukraine. We're going to drop a missile from them in Ramstein, and then we'll put the pressure on you. Are you going to fire back? Because if you fire back, we'll shoot those missiles down. Because in actual fact, the Russians have got escalation dominance in this situation. NATO can't do anything. As I said earlier, it would take months, possibly years, to get an army that would be sufficient to try and deal with the situation in the Ukraine. And the Russians would see that punch coming a mile off. They've got submarines which would sink the ships, bringing stuff over from the United States. And you'd have to have a battle of the Atlantic with the Russians playing the role of the Germans.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. It seemed like Boris Johnson is hanging around in the background doing what he can to facilitate that. I mean, I suppose I also ought to say something I mentioned on the Richie Allen show on Monday, which is that there's a possibility. I mean, we had this suggestion a couple of weeks ago when we were looking at the leaks that came out about Joe Biden, that there's pressure being put on these political leaders in order to escalate the war in Ukraine, and that Biden is being told, look, sign on the dotted line, send the tanks, send whatever it is we are saying over. This is the NATO and the military, Pentagon people, the military industrial complex saying, look, let's escalate this war in Ukraine. And if you don't like it, Biden, we're going to leak stories about you leaking secret material.
Yeah, it may well be. I mean, I've certainly seen people saying that these leaks are very convenient in terms of putting Biden in a corner where he can't say no. You feel like saying to these people behind all of this, where's your end game here?
Because they don't have a plan. Anyway,
that's right.
Is a man with a plan, supposedly, and let's see what Martin makes of it.
Battle tanks are, of course, important, both to be able to repel Russian new offensives, but also for Ukraine to be able to retake territory, to win and to prevail as a sovereign independent nation in Europe. At the same time, we need to understand that allies have already decided to deliver both battle tanks, but also to deliver more armored vehicles, including infantry fighting vehicles. So what we need is heavier, more modern equipment, and that's exactly what allies have already announced to deliver. Germany has announced to deliver Marder infantry fighting vehicles. The United States has decided to deliver many Bradleys and Strikers and also other types of armored vehicles. Canada, other allies are also stepping up with different types of armored vehicles and infantry fighting vehicles. Then some allies have already delivered battle tanks, including some of our eastern allies. France has announced that they will deliver a light battle tank. And then the United Kingdom has announced that they will deliver modern main battle tank, the Challenger 2. So if you put all of this together, the German announcements, the announcements from other allies of a wide range of different types of armor to Ukraine, this is a huge additional contribution to the combat capabilities of Ukraine. And this is urgent, this is important, because Russia is preparing for new offensives. We need to enable the Ukrainians soon or fast to be able to repel those offensives and also enable them to retake, liberate their own territory. Then we had the good discussion today on the issue of German battle tanks. And I'm confident that there will be a solution soon. And I welcome also the clear message from the minister that other allies, other NATO allies that have Leopard battle tanks are of course free to identify those Leopard battle tanks that may be available for Ukraine to make them ready, but also to start training of Ukrainian crews for those battle tanks. Because after decision has been taken on delivery of battle tanks, it will take some time to identify, to make ready, and to train Ukrainian crews. And I welcome the clear message from Minister Pretorius that allies with Leopard battle tanks are actually urged to start that work.
So, yes, Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, Martin, explaining why the tanks are going to make all the difference.
Well, as he pointed out, we've only just agreed to send these tanks. We've got to train people to use them. Don't forget, because it's a hodgepodge of different tanks, they'll all be have to train different, you know, different people to train them. And the Ukrainian army was trained to fight on Soviet kit. So what they did at one stage is the Russian army smashed the
existing. Didn't they get them some arms dealers from other countries?
Well, they did. But the second iteration, as the second iteration of the Ukrainian army, was they plundered the ex-Warsaw Pact kit from all of the
Bulgaria,
East European
Romania,
countries,
et cetera,
and the Ukrainian army at least was trained to fight on it. But don't forget, the Ukrainian army is taking up to 150,000 killed in action, and probably hundreds of thousands of others completely useless as fighting. You know, they've killed off all the NCOs and you know, sergeant majors and such like. So the Ukrainian army's on. You know, I don't think that this can be done without putting probably like Polish, Bulgarian, Romanian NATO forces into Ukraine in Ukrainian uniforms. But the Russians have already said, we know what you're doing, we know what this is like, what you're trying to do here. It's obviously annoys us that you're escalating instead of looking for a negotiated solution. But if you send these tanks, we will destroy them, we'll kill the people in them, and if you are going to say that NATO is attacking us, then we will hit back, and we will hit back hard. So we might attack Salisbury Plain, where you're doing your training. Yeah? That's a military target, it's a great big military base. If we land a missile on there and kill hundreds of your soldiers, don't complain. You can try firing back at Russia, but we will shoot it down. What are you going to do, get your nuclear weapons out?
So let's have a listen now to former UN Weapons Inspector, US Marine Corps Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter, with his take. And he was chatting to Clayton Morris yesterday.
For the last 20 years, NATO and the United States have been focused singularly on Afghanistan and the Middle East. The last thing they've been doing is preparing for large-scale ground combat in Europe. The Russians have been preparing for large-scale ground combat in Europe since 2008. In 2016, they fundamentally reworked their organizational structures, and they're continuing to update them today for the sole purpose of closing with and destroying a NATO-style army. That doesn't just mean how NATO fights doctrinally, but the equipment. Every piece of Russian equipment that's in the Russian inventory today has been designed and is intended to kill NATO tanks. So if people think that the Leopard 2 showing up on the battlefield is suddenly going to scare the Russians, you're wrong. They're ready for it. They've trained for it, and they have the equipment to deal death and destruction. And for the Germans, I just don't know what's going through their brains.
Yeah.
The idea of putting German tanks on Ukrainian soil for the purpose of killing Russians. Man, that didn't work out too good the last time they did it, and it's not going to work out too good this time.
Yeah, it seems like instead of going the opposite direction and moving towards peace, we're doubling down on this. Now, Russia, of course, amplifying its rhetoric over the past 24 hours and saying, this is an extension now of the targets, right? You're now opening up the targets. This isn't just the Ukrainian battlefield now. This gives, I mean, you can speak to that a little bit, what you're hearing from Russia now, that you're sort of expanding the battlefield beyond just Ukraine. We're now actively looking at, you know, you have Portugal announcing these tanks are going to be delivered through Spain. They're actively telling us how on rail lines they're going to be delivering these tanks through Spain. So they're going to be coming from Poland and all of these different locations. What do you make of that side from the Russian side of this now?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the Ukrainian defense minister last month just straight out said that Ukraine is a de facto member of NATO. That the Ukrainian army is a proxy NATO force, and that Ukraine's willing to sacrifice its blood, but it must receive the equipment from NATO in order to carry out these tasks. So by his own definition, which then was, you could say, well, that's just an irresponsible, overenthusiastic Ukrainian official. Then you back it up with the meeting of the Ramstein contact group on January 20th, where all of the defense ministers of NATO and other nations who aren't NATO, like Sweden and Finland and such, got together and without exception articulated a similar theory of their involvement, that this is about a NATO war with Russia. The German foreign minister just said it straight up to her European colleagues. Germany is at war with Russia. Let's be clear. Russia has every legal right to attack any place in Europe that is involved in the transfer of these weapons to Ukraine. By agreeing to transfer these weapons to Ukraine, every nation that has said, yes, this is what we're going to do, has become an active participant in the conflict. And under the laws of war, Russia can take them out. Now, here's the good news. Russia is simply putting a marker down and saying, You've just increased our target deck. We can do this. But Russia has been managing escalation from the very beginning. And the last thing Russia wants is to turn this into not just a de facto, but a de jure of conflict between NATO and Russia, because now it's nuclear war and it's over. So I don't see, at least in this iteration, Russia reaching out and touching Polish logistics centers, German railheads, Spanish tunnels. I don't see that happening because Russia doesn't need to do that. Russia's winning this war, hands down. And Russia's going to win this war, hands down. But Russia is letting NATO know that if by some strange set of occurrences, all this equipment showed up in Ukraine and Ukrainians were able to assemble a mailed fist that threatened Crimea or anything else, that it's game set over. I mean, Russia will open up and unleash everything they have on NATO because NATO is an active participant in this conflict. And again, if you take a look at Russian nuclear doctrine, one of the conditions for the use of nuclear weapons is if NATO or a NATO-like entity assembles sufficient conventional military power that threatens the existential survival of Russia. So what NATO is seeking to do, they're not going to accomplish it, but what they're seeking to do is give Ukraine the ability to act as a NATO proxy to threaten the existential survival of Russia, which means Russia, if this actually occurred, would use nuclear weapons, not on Ukraine. They've said it straight up. This isn't going to be a tactical nuclear weapon against Ukraine. They're going to hit NATO. They're going to hit London. They're going to hit Berlin. They're going to hit Paris. They're going to hit Brussels. They're going to hit Madrid. They're going to hit Lisbon. Hey, Portugal, good job. You just made yourself a nuclear target. This is the reality. Now, the good news is Russia's winning this war and they're going to win this war. Russia's ready for this. They're prepared for this. But politically, this is an escalation. And imagine, put yourself in Russia's shoes. What NATO's saying is they want to kill Russians. They want to kill Russians. This isn't some mathematical game with tanks and steel and all this kind of stuff. It's not a computer game. This is reality. Now, I've said that what all they're doing is actually enabling Russia to slaughter more Ukrainians. That's the truth. But let's say that, you know, because the blade of war cuts both ways. That's just the harsh reality of it. That the same blade you'd use to kill somebody is cutting you. And let's say Russia gets away with a 10-to-1 casualty ratio. That's a fantastic ratio, almost impossible to achieve, but they're doing that now. But let's say the new tanks come in and Russia sustains this, and they kill 40,000 Ukrainian troops, which is what's going to happen. Russia's going to lose 4,000 dead. That's 4,000 mothers, 4,000 wives, 4,000 daughters, 4,000 sisters, 4,000 grandmothers and uncles and brothers and sons that are going to lose loved ones. This is unforgivable.
So that's Scott Ritter there. Pretty forceful as usual. His statistics are interesting. Do you believe the 10-to-1 kill ratio? He's saying that 10 Ukrainians are dying for every one Russian.
What the Russians have been doing is fighting a battle of attrition. Because the Ukrainians, the Ukrainians could have withdrawn from the occupied oblasts and defended the, and created a defensive line further west, and the Russians would have left them alone. But they won't withdraw. Not only won't they withdraw, they've been encouraged by idiots like Boris Johnson that we're going to take all this territory back. Now, what that means is that the Ukrainians are under political pressure from the West. We provided the tanks. Now you've got to attack with these tanks. But it's like sending people over the top in the First World War. The Russians probably will not attack Salisbury Plain, I was suggesting earlier. They will wait for these tanks to appear in Ukraine, and then they will kill the tanks. And the other thing that Western military industrial complex isn't really happy about this is because these tanks are their tanks. They won't have any tanks left. And if the Russian kit is shown to be completely superior to this old tat, which is what it is, then the Russian arms industry is going to take a huge boost in the
Sounds to me like the West, and particularly NATO, is running out of rope.
They are. They've provoked this, but they've started it, but they don't know how to finish it. They started it with the coup in 2014 in Kiev, where a NATO death squad, I keep repeating this, but it's worth repeating because most people don't realise this, the people who were shot down in the Maidan Square protesting to join the European Union were shot down by a NATO death squad organised from Georgia by Shakashvili, the guy in charge, according to the testimony given in court in Kiev on a video, was the guy in charge, was an American officer called Boyenga. Okay? That's who started the war. At the very beginning. And then when the Crimea and the Eastern Oblast voted to secede from Ukraine, which is exactly what Slovenia did in Yugoslavia, Kosovo did in Serbia, Bosnia declared independence of Yugoslavia, and we went to war to force the Yugoslavian government to accept the independence of these independent republics. A 78-day bombing campaign killed thousands of people, but by goodness, NATO got its way. Kosovo is an independent state, although it's not recognised by many countries. The Russians have done nothing different from that. Their nationals, which is what they now are, in those eastern oblasts who didn't want to be ruled from Kiev and were then attacked, losing thousands and thousands of civilian casualties, the Russian military went in under responsibility to protect them. Just as Britain went to the Falklands for exactly the same kind of reason. And the Argentinians, let's remember, hadn't killed one single Brit. Not one. They just occupied it without firing a shot. The Kiev regime, with our backing, has killed tens of thousands of Russian-speaking civilians.
Okay, so just now on Reuters, the Ukrainian ambassador to France has said there are now 321 heavy tanks promised to Ukraine by several countries. On French TV, he said, Vladimir Omelchenko, Ukraine's ambassador to France, has said 321 heavy tanks. Delivery terms vary for each case. We need this help as soon as possible. And that's quite a lot of tanks. Obviously, in the military doctrine, an armoured division is something you don't want to necessarily have to deal with. And the Russians are thinking, we don't really want to deal with an armoured division. Roughly 50 tanks in a brigade. You're talking about two armoured divisions for the Ukrainian army. I suppose there are some people in Ukraine who are rubbing their hands now.
Yeah, well, they're not there yet. You know, you've got to get their fustest with the mostest, as General Patton famously said. They're not there yet. And even when they get there, they're going to be massively outnumbered by the Russian tanks,
which are superior,
and they've got no air superiority.
The Russians As far as I understand it, the Russians don't have a lot of tanks in the field right now.
They've got a hell of a lot more than that.
They may well do if this all goes ahead. Let's assume that the Ukrainians do manage to get hold of these tanks and intact attack the Russians with two armoured divisions. Now, that's not necessarily, the Russians may take them out, but it's surely going to make quite a big hole in the line, and it could be a game changer in the war.
Well, you had Scott Ritter, who's a military man, earlier on the show. I obviously have got no military training whatsoever, but it strikes me that the people who are talking like this are talking out of their backsides.
Well, there's several steps to get there, aren't there? You've got to get the tanks there. You've got to train the people up. But I mean,
it's the tyranny of geography. Yeah. Russia is right next door. All of their kit is just right there, ready to be used. NATO is basically a ragtag army of various nations stretching right across the Atlantic. And, they're just not going to be able to concentrate. If the Russians tried to invade the United States from Mexico, they'd be smashed. If the Cubans tried it, they'd be smashed. Then if NATO tries to turn up on Russia's doorstep and tries to invade Russia, because that's not what they'd be doing now, because these oblasts are now part of the Russian Federation, by voting, then they're going to be smashed.
Okay, we're going to have to cover a few more stories before we finish. One is Pakistan. They're in the middle of an economic crisis, obviously got rid last year of their elected prime minister through bribery from the Central Intelligence Agency of the parliament, various MPs then voting to get rid of Imran Khan. The consequences of a hostile nuclear neighbour that is now bankrupt. That's one of the Indian papers saying Pakistan has an economic crisis. The country's rupee has recorded the highest one-day fall in 20 years. The biggest economic crisis in two decades. In talks with the IMF for bailout packages, blackouts and severe foreign currency shortages, Pakistan's economy at risk of collapse. Sounds like we may be getting Farooq Siddiq from the Bristol Pakistan Society in sometime soon to talk about some of this, but it's a bit of a disaster, isn't it? And this is all supposed to be because Imran Khan was corrupt. Now the place seems to be falling apart. But I mean, they've got all sorts of trouble with their gas supplies. For example, quite a lot of people in Pakistan have got nice gas cookers, but there ain't no gas.
Well, I mean, what Brian Eno called propaganda is at work here. So we are talking about the Ukraine, and maybe we should be talking about Pakistan. Maybe we should be talking about all these other places. Maybe we should be talking about Yemen. Maybe we should be talking about what's going on in Mexico. There's more people dying.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do.
Mexico, week in, week out, than dying in Ukraine. And it's just the drug war.
Journalism, as an editor, you've got to try and look at what is the actual impact of whatever's going on to how many people. And I suppose the other aspect of it is can things be done about it? Well, of course they can. In Pakistan, for example, any country which is independent of the global financial system, like Libya, seems to have been just decimated because they're not beholden to the IMF. Britain, of course, is itself in a massive debt trap too.
Well, the whole of the Western world is run by finance capital bandits, basically. Pakistan has been deliberately destabilized. Imran Khan was a hope for the people of the country, but he's been removed by our friends in MI6.
They've removed the CIA. And he still is a hope. Let's say he's still alive. Yes. And he's still saying, look, guys, I'm still here. I'm going to run the country. And he did an interview last week with the BBC. Here's an extract from that.
Now, Imran Khan, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, has warned the country could face economic collapse if there isn't a general election soon. Mr. Khan was ousted in a vote of no confidence last April. Since then, he's pushed the government to bring the elections forward, but his critics say his efforts are adding to the country's economic problems. He spoke to our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davis.
The only way Pakistan could get economic stability is through free and fair elections. Free and fair elections where a government backed by a popular mandate, that's the beginning of getting economic stability.
But those elections are due to happen this year. What you are calling for is to have them earlier. What's the difference? It's just a few months. But the fact that you're doing this
could cause further economic damage. Will you acknowledge that?
Actually, the damage has been done. It's only going to get worse. The longer this government stays, the worry in Pakistan is we could have a Sri Lanka-type situation.
Would you bring people out to protest if you don't get the agenda that you want to happen?
We will do public rallies. Of course, we're already in an election year, so we will do our public rallies, which is what political parties do.
There is still a threat hanging over you that you could be disqualified. What will you do if you are disqualified?
There is absolutely no case that can disqualify me.
Do you think it'll happen?
Well, they're trying their best because, you know, I have so many court cases. They come up with every other day there's a new case against me, and I keep appearances in courts.
What would you do? Who would run the party? How would this operate if you were disqualified?
Well, we'll cross the bridge when we come to it.
There will be an election this year at some point. How safe do you currently feel?
I don't feel safe. The answer is no, I don't feel safe. Thing is, yes, I'll be a little bit more careful. I will have a bulletproof scream now giving, rallies. But I will have to. There's no question of me sitting inside. You know, I will go out campaigning.
Mr. Khan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Caroline Davis with that interview.
Well, as you said there will be an election this year, but of course, if it looks as if Imran Khan's party is going to win, there might not be an election because the army will prevent one with the support of United States and Britain. And of course, Imran Khan was removed after he went to Moscow at the beginning of the Russian special operation in Ukraine, and basically he's refused to go along with sanctions on Russia. And he did deals with the Russians, as Farouk pointed out a few weeks ago. He did deals for food and for energy, and of course that ran against ran counter to the world community lining up against Russia, and that's why he was removed. It's another part of the big struggle between the Western deep state and the rest of humanity.
Israel has launched airstrikes on Gaza tonight as rockets were fired after a deadly Jenin raid. The Israeli warplanes target besieged enclave, according to the Middle East Eye. Rocket fire has been intercepted by the Iron Dome, the Israeli missile defence system type thing. Israel has launched airstrikes in the besieged Gaza Strip at dawn on Friday after rockets were fired from the Palestinian enclave following one of the deadliest Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank in recent years. Going back to the raid itself, Martin, the Israelis said, we believe that people in there were part of Islamic Jihad and that they were about to attack Israel. And so we decided to get in there first and kill them.
Well, they killed a grandmother as one of their victims.
They've killed 9 Palestinians and wounded 20 others. Apparently they were really supposed to be in there arresting them, but obviously that didn't happen.
Well, the new right-wing government in Israel is determined to provoke a conflict with the Palestinians because they hope that they can ethnically cleanse them out of the West Bank by force. They've got no intention of making peace. They never have. At some point, they're going to provoke a war with Lebanon or with Iran, and that's going to lead to a massive confrontation. And don't forget, the Russian army is deployed in Syria. We're looking at World War III here, and it's not just in the Ukraine. And if all these battle tanks end up in the Ukraine, what are they going to do if they have to fight in the Middle East? Because they won't have any tanks left.
Abbas's government has also announced that it will be stopping its controversial policy of security coordination with Israel in response to the killings. Quite a lot of people killed there, Martin. But again, what do you make this idea that, you know, our intelligence tells us that these people are planning a raid?
Well, that's not what it is at all. There is a more militant mood on the Palestinian side. They're not prepared to just lie down and take it in the ways that they have previously. But in actual fact, the real change here is you've got the most right-wing government in Israel since the 1940s or ever. And they were pretty right-wing in the 1940s. They carried out massive ethnic cleansing. I've just been reading a book, State of Terror, the terrorist origins of the State of Israel. And they've basically been murdering killing and repressing the local population for all these decades.
And the Brits, Brits.
Yes, well,
when we occupied
But the British also had been involved in trying to repress the Palestinians to prevent them expressing themselves. And, of course, we gave the country to the Zionists against the wishes of the local population, because it was our responsibility. And of course,
well, we were bombed out. Let's be frank about this. The British were completely outgunned and bombed out of Israel.
They were bombed out of Israel because the Zionist lobby in the United States was so strong that Ernie Bevin, who was the foreign secretary at the time, he was prepared to stand up to them and say, we're not going to give them a state. Would Ernie Bevin be classed as an anti-Semite by Keir Starmer, even though he was very, very right-wing Labour? But he was not prepared to give in to terrorists in Israel.
But these
nobody should have given in to terrorists in Israel. They shouldn't have had a state in the first place.
These are like gung-ho cops in Israel. They're supposed to go in and arrest people. They end up killing 20, and
but this is in Jenin in the West Bank, which they're not supposed to be there. Yeah? They're not supposed to be there at all. Jenin is a refugee camp. It's not a normal community. It's people who've been driven out of other parts of Palestine and pushed into this refugee camp in the 1940s.
Okay, so yeah, sorry, it's 9 killed and 20 injured.
Yeah, so what they're doing is the Israeli right-wing government, we're now on it, because the Israeli electorate has decided that they want to go for broke. Yeah. Now, that means that they're going to provoke a war in the Middle East in which we in Britain are going to pay the price. And people in the United States who fund the state of Israel to the tune of millions of dollars every year, they think that they're not going to be touched by this. But sooner or later, they are going to be touched by all of this.
Well, there's been a development tonight, Martin. 7 Israelis have been killed in East Jerusalem in a settlement shooting. 10 others were wounded in the attack inside an illegal Israeli settlement where the suspected shooter was also killed. So obviously there is, there's been countering this.
You could say that these settlers are civilians, but in actual fact, the legal justification for those settlements is that they are military bases in order to keep Israel safe. So they are legitimate military targets according to Israeli law. Yeah, the only legal justification for those settlements is that they are they're military bases. So they are actually legitimate targets of attack. And there's no use them complaining, saying, but they're with civilians. They're not civilians. They're in the wrong place. They shouldn't be there. That Israel should be inside the line that was agreed in 1948, not 1967. And if they won't agree to any, be going back inside the line of 1948, then there's a big question about whether the state should be allowed to exist at all. Because they're setting a very bad example for all these other conflicts around the world.
This could escalate.
If they're allowed to get away with
this
stuff, everybody else can get
Martin,
away with stuff.
This could escalate this weekend. Israeli police said the shooter arrived by car around 8:15 p.m. local time today outside a building used as a synagogue in the settlement of Nev Yaakov. He then opened fire at people in the area before fleeing the scene on foot, where he encountered a police force and died in an exchange of fire. The Magen David Adom Emergency Response Service said medics were treating 10 victims in multiple conditions, including critical. So a State Department said Washington condemns the attack and the US is in direct touch with Israeli partners, according to Reuters. So this is quite clear that Abbas is, they have no longer any security cooperation, because what they were saying was, if you tell us, that you're going to raid a particular area, we will try and make sure as few people get killed as possible. But the Israelis seem to have thrown that in the dustbin.
Well, I wouldn't say I approve of this attack. But you can understand why, if you were a young Palestinian who'd been, from the camp in Jenin, you might feel that this is a time to make them cry as well. The point is that we could easily see escalation in Ukraine, in Israel, in Yemen, everywhere, all at once, boom, and it'll just overwhelm us, and it'll be part of a general crisis because the financial system in the West is on the verge of implosion. So there we are. We are where we are, aren't we? It's horrendous.
Well, I suppose we are, but this could really escalate this one, couldn't it? US, in the meantime, with China, we mustn't miss China out, must we? The US Marines have opened a new base on Guam. Martin.
Well, I mean, the idea that what we've got to do is contain the Chinese, who are, the main power in Southeast Asia, I'd like to ask Rishi Sunak and maybe Nigel Farage, what is the interest of ordinary British people who can't feed their kids or pay their heating bills to go to the South China Sea and provoke the Chinese, who ought to be our trade partners? What the hell's that about? It
seems to me to be almost like an escalation on all fronts.
Well, it is an escalation on all fronts.
I mean, we've just been
You saw Rishi Sunak boasting earlier about the billions we have sent to the Ukraine, which has all been stolen by Ukrainian mafia
oligarchs.
Well,
we've just been chatting to Mandy Sharman here about it. Well, I mean, this is an escalation against the citizens of Bristol. Some of the poorest citizens and the people living in their boats, they're having a go at them. And also an escalation, you know, in other ways, in other parts of the world.
This has been the way it's been going for quite a while, Tony. Yeah, all the years we've been doing this program, we've been marching in lockstep.
Maybe 2023 is going to be a big one. We'll see. Anyway, penultimate item tonight is part of my Mark Purdy investigation. And here is what was behind BSE in the UK. Mark Purdy died in suspicious circumstances not long after I interviewed him, but he was campaigning for against the organic phosphate pesticides. And managed to prove, I think, pretty much beyond any reasonable doubt, that it was actually the pesticides that were responsible for BSE, CJD. But, of course, the manufacturers of the pesticides never wanted to admit that. So, of course, the Minister of Agriculture could never admit that. Anyway, Mark said what he thinks was behind BSE here in Britain.
I became very aware of a campaign that was carried out by the Minister of Agriculture called the Warblefly Eradication Campaign. And under this order, farmers in Great Britain were forced by law to use what's known as a systemic organophosphate poron chemical. And this oil-like pesticide had to be poured along the spinal canal of the cows. And it was designed to penetrate right through the skin of the cows and poison the whole internal environment of the cow into a sort of poisonous medium. Well, this one on from the late 70s through the early part of the 1980s, just before BSE erupted. So the timing seemed to fit the bill. But Britain, Great Britain, was unique in using very high doses of one particular type of organophosphate pesticide. The organophosphates were derived from the military nerve gases, and this in its shelves shows the toxicity of this group of chemicals. But this particular systemic formulation had to be poured along the spine of the cow. And in a sense, you're delivering it millimetres from where the damage in BSE actually appears. And in BSE, it seems that all that causes the disease is a change in the molecular conformation of a particular protein called the prion protein that has a very crucial function in maintaining the balance of the nervous system. And so anything to do with the nervous system, which interlinks with the immune system, the psychiatric system, the neurological system, a disturbance at this very basic level will cause exactly the types of symptoms, the brain pathology that you get in the BSE class of diseases. Great Britain was unique in applying massive doses of this particular type of pesticide. It was hardly used in any other countries, but it was used a bit in Switzerland, it was used a bit in France and in Ireland, and perhaps it's no coincidence that these three other countries are countries that have a very small amount of BSE, and in fact their use in these other countries was at a lower dose rate, and also it was voluntary, it wasn't compelled. And I believe that Britain had this massive epidemic was because they were compelled to use this chemical at a high dose rate twice a year, and that was exclusive to the UK.
It's the lovely guy as well, Mark Purdy. Real privilege to meet him and film him back in 2000, I think it was, with our Eye Contact video network. The final item this week is just very simple one. You can stay for this, Martin, because it is one of the Prime Minister's questions, and it's got a kind of spiritual angle to it.
Freedom of religion or belief is important in this country. Isabel von Spruce was praying silently outside an abortion clinic in Birmingham when she was arrested and questioned by the police, not about her written or spoken words, but about her thoughts. We value freedom of religion or belief in this country. Will the Prime Minister commit to examine the laws of the United Kingdom to ensure that this country remains a beacon for freedom of religion or belief across the world?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course, we believe in freedom of religious expression and belief in this country, but we also are balancing that with the rights of women to seek legal and safe abortions. That is currently being discussed in this Parliament. These matters are always matters of free vote, and I know members will treat them with the sensitivity that they deserve.
Yeah, so Isabel Vaughan Spruce was arrested in Birmingham for praying.
Was she arrested or was she just cautioned?
She was arrested.
And what was she charged with?
Interviewed. Well, we don't know if she's been charged yet. The police, I don't think, have decided whether to charge her or not. But she was a pro-life activist, 45 years old, arrested and charged with four counts of breaching an exclusion zone outside an abortion clinic at King's Norton. She will appear in court next week on the 2nd of February. Birmingham City Council introduced the public space protection order at the clinic to ensure people visiting and working there have clear access without fear of confrontation. So this is a sort of thing that was used to stop demonstrations in a way. I suppose she's doing a demonstration by praying, but she's certainly what do you make of it?
Obviously I'm pro-abortion and obviously Tony you're not, but I would say that if you are a prisoner of conscience like this, you've got to take people like I've forgotten her name now, who broke into the base at Fairford and carried out with criminal damage. Do you remember the woman I'm speaking
Angie
of?
Angie Zelter?
No, it was another. It was somebody we know personally. I can't remember the name of the person now. You've got to turn the other cheek.
Margaret.
Yeah, and we know her as Margaret, but I can't remember her second name. Rishi Sunak said there that we're going to protect the rights of people to go and seek abortions without being harassed. That's it.
Well, I was at the Museum of Witchcraft in Boscastle last year, and there was an interesting little side exhibition on Satanism. And one of the two things that they said that the Satanists are into was infiltrating churches, and the second one was encouraging abortion.
All right, Tony, you're against abortion.
I'm in favour
of women's right to choose.
Are you a Satanist?
No, I'm not a Satanist.
Right, okay. I'm just saying, that's what these Satanists say. This is Anton LaVey and that lot. This is what they say is very important. We must have more abortions.
Mm. Well, your position is clear, but you're in a minority in this country, and they're in a minority in Northern Ireland.
Well, I've always been in a minority, Martin, and actually, funnily enough, so are you. Not on this issue, maybe, but on many issues, certainly on Ukraine. So let's leave it there. Thanks ever so much, Martin Summers, and also particularly to our guest, Mandy Sharman. That is it for now, for this week. Time to sign off. Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko, particularly Mandy Sharman, though, our excellent guest. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. Somebody texted me during the show, actually, to talk about a story which is, unbelievable, really. But apparently this guy called Daniel Harris has been jailed for 11 years. The video included lessons to be learnt from Brenton Tarrant, who live-streamed an attack in which he killed 51 people at mosques in New Zealand in March 2019. So haven't really got a chance to properly look at this week, but we'll have a look next week maybe. Amazing story. I mean, jailed for 11 years for making a video. Far right, I suppose this is one of those Order of the Nine Angles type accelerationist things. But anyway, the website is thisweekoneword.org.uk. Everything's there. Subscribe to the weekly email list or anything else you like. My paperbacks are available via bilderberg.org. Just click through if your browser tries to stop you, or if you can't, get rid of that browser and get a better one. And those books are on Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers. Also my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination. The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're both on eBay, and you'll find this, and actually on, I think it's called Bibliophile as well, but if you go to bookfinder.com, you'll definitely get them via there. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on this stream. I think that James at Radio Q said that this show is being repeated during the week early. I think it was 6 a.m. or something. But we have been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the apps, the BCFM Politics Show app, not the BCFM Politics Show app, sorry. And if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know, and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, talkradio.org.uk, and the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.